Board of Education regular meeting will now come to order. Mr. Kenwood, would you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. Stecker, will you please call the roll?
Mr. Allen?
Here.
Mr. Kenwood?
Here.
Ms. Nelson?
Here.
Ms. Smith?
Here.
Mr. Powers?
Here.
Mr. Dolan?
Here.
Mr. Bondra?
Are there any members of the public who wish to address the board at this time? Okay, hearing none, we have no recognition items tonight. We'll move on to presentations, reports, and initiative updates. Item A, the bullying task force recommendation.
Well, as you know, we have convened a task force back in November to look at bullying in the district and look at the research surrounding bullying nationally. And so I couldn't be more pleased and proud to present to tonight's recommendations and the work of the task force. I'd like to begin by announcing those who will be presenting tonight, and then I'd like to ask everyone who was a member of the task force who was able to be present tonight to also stand. But representing the Research and Review Committee, Denise McGrath, who is one of our parents, and Jenny Gygas, a social worker, will be doing the presentation. For the Definition and Response Study Group, Patricia Hart Nouse, a fifth grade teacher, will be doing that portion of the presentation. Our school climate will be presented by John Bauer, fourth grade teacher, and Molly Manzilla, a parent. And community engagement and education will be presented by Jeremy Vargel. And what I'd like is for every member of the task force who is here tonight to please stand and be recognized for the great work that you've done. So before we get going, and Patricia is going to begin by providing us with a background in this, I just wanted to say publicly how much I appreciate the work that this group did and how independent and self-motivated and initiating they were in their work. They were given a charge in a general category to begin doing research and derive some recommendations. It was very loosely facilitated by me. Each group developed its own structure and we gave them some templates to work from, but really they developed their own style and their own form, and they went after their work in a way that best met the needs of that group. And as always, the process worked, and the talent in our community and among our staff was evident in the work that they produced, and so I couldn't be happier than to have them present the starting point tonight. And Patricia's going to begin. And Mike will just sort of follow along with her.
Good evening. Bullying is an issue throughout the country as well as here within our own school district and community. Concerns among our staff and in our community are growing relative to the dangers of bullying and the long-term effect bullying has on the victim and the bully. With the desire to be proactive in responding to growing concerns, an invitation to interested staff, parents, and community was sent in October to join this task force. Over 40 people representing staff, community, and parents responded. Four study groups were developed, and the self-selected group members met seven times to prepare their findings and their reports. The first group was a definition and response group that was charged with defining bullying, developing a matrix representing behaviors and responses to those behaviors, and making policy recommendations. Then there was the research and review committee charged with identifying research best practices to act proactively to prevent and to intervene to stop bullying behavior. The school climate was charged with identifying those qualities that must be present in a school community that make for a positive climate when bullying is not possible. And then we have the community engagement and education committee. They were charged with creating ideas related to outreach to the larger community, where responsibility for eradicating bullying belongs to everyone in the community.
Here's research and response. Denise and Jenny.
Good afternoon.
afternoon, or good evening, excuse me. I'm Denise McGrath. I was one of the parents who was involved in this committee. And our group, we had a wonderful talent of parents, a social worker, several teachers from the district, as well as a school administrator. And basically, we spent our time together collecting research that either one of us found and shared, or we all discovered, shared that research, and then came back and discussed our research with the goal of identifying at least 10 best practices to help identify ways that bullying can be prevented in our schools. But before we talked about our best practices, we thought it was important to identify a bullying definition. And of all the definitions that are out there are three features that are essential in all of them. The first one is that bullying is purposeful and aggressive. The second is that there's an imbalance of power between the victim and the bully. And the third is that it occurs more than once. So basically, it's an imbalance of power. So I'm going to share with you our first six best practices. We actually came up with 12. And then Jenny will do the last six. So the first one is establish a positive school climate. Research says that a school climate is the key factor that determines whether young people will be both bullied in our schools. So what is a positive school climate? It is this: when students feel comfortable, safe, wanted, valued, respected, accepted, and secure in their environment. It's a place where they can interact with caring people that they trust. A positive school climate affects everyone associated with the school: staff, parents, teachers, and the students. All the relationships in the school are affected by the school climate. This includes the staff-to-staff relationships, it includes the staff-to-student relationships, and of course it affects the student-to-student relationships. Simply put, it's the overall feel of the school. A positive school climate can be achieved through supporting social-emotional learning and by working with the entire school community to engage in norms about, to change the norms about bullying. The second best practice is to do a thorough assessment. What is occurring in our schools? What does staff say about bullying? What about the parents and the kids? It is critical to start any bullying prevention effort with an assessment of the existing bullying climate. It is important to survey the entire school community. The assessment should identify attitudes and beliefs. It should identify the prevalence of bullying as well as the perceptions. It might also give insight to the hotspots where bullying is occurring. Is it occurring in the library, on the bus? And then it's just important to understand that the assessment is not a one-time only process. It should be continued throughout the whole process. And use as an evaluation tool as well. Our third best practice is to take the team approach. This is not the job of a single person. It's not the job of the principal of the school or a teacher, but it's rather a team approach. It should be made up of representatives from every area of the school, and it should also reflect the community's diversity. And that is, consider race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, and family structure when you're forming your bullying team. Number four, align with research-based bullying curriculum. This one's great because there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. Proven research-based models exist. One that we looked at quite carefully was the Olveus model. And that's a program that offers guidance, materials, tools that can be adapted to district policies and programming. The fifth one is invest in training and education. The greatest program in the world is worthless if people are not trained and it's not well executed. So I think it goes without saying that the most extensive training would have to go to those who are actually on the team in charge of executing the plan. But also we need to train teachers, all the staff, basically anyone who comes in contact with our children, right down to the parent volunteers. It should address all the issues of bullying. It should also include some efforts such as family planning night or family training nights where we gather families from the community. And we can invite professionals and experts to help with this training. And then, of course, we have to educate our students, the victims, the bystanders. And our sixth one is to develop and use school-wide behavioral rubric that features clear, consistent expectations. What's great about this is everybody's on the same page. There's not different rules when there's a substitute, or if there's not different rules depending on what teacher you have. It's consistency within the whole district. There's no guesswork, and everybody is using the same language.
All right, our looking at our seventh best practice, we want to develop very age-appropriate, anonymous, student-safe reporting mechanisms. This has been seen in different schools, such as drop boxes, subtle passes to request teacher conferences to ask for assistance, online communication, and other ideas that are age-appropriate for the students. We are trying to teach children self-advocacy skills, and we need to find the best way to support them in being comfortable to use these skills to ask for help. Our next one, facilitate consistent and ongoing engagement with key stakeholders. This is the community, students, parents, and all other people that are involved within the school setting. Keep communication ongoing through parent newsletters, from the school as a whole, parent newsletters from teachers, if there's trainings and opportunities within the community, information nights along with curriculum nights and community events. We need to make sure that these trainings are and different information is available throughout the year so it can be consistent. Our next one is providing appropriate resources and referrals for both proactive and reactive bullying management. Proactive resources would look at being able to identify where are those hot spots, whether it's the hallway, the recess, the lunchroom, the playground, knowing where the place is and finding and having the knowledge to know where does this occur the most, and then adding more support to where that is. So being proactive and looking at those areas that need the most supervision. Other proactive skills that are really great to work with directly with the students, offering students training in social skills, problem solving strategy, regularly reinforcing pro-social behavior, especially using peer buddy strategies to create opportunities, especially with new students as well too, for students to feel more comfortable across social groups, and also most importantly too, to empower the bystanders and other children if they're seeing this happen, to withhold support for bullying behaviors. Reactive strategies would include giving support to the victims to develop safety plans and ways in which they can get help if it's needed. Develop interventions for the bullies to offer to help them to identify what behavior is there and how they can fix it. Offer in-school counseling and definitely as well as outside social skills group and other professionals for all those involved, especially for the families too. A really important one that we look at, embrace the restorative approach to bullying. It continues to be the no-tolerance policy of bullying behavior, but it's not looking at zero tolerance in terms of we've seen it before. Research is suggesting that just detention, suspensions, or expulsions are not as effective because this is very reactive and it is not looking at a culture of care. It's not necessarily taking what's happening and looking how we can make it better. It does not give the bully skills and the ability to learn and utilize these tools to change how they're acting in this environment. Use this as a teachable moment for both the bully and the victim. Help the victim create a safety plan, develop self-advocacy skills, and help them find their voice. A restorative approach focuses on the strengths perspective, so looking at how we can use our skills to plan a resolution and repair the harm. Looking at two, avoiding mediation. This is something that is kind of coming up in research that's a little bit new. In a bullying situation, there's an imbalance of power, and mediation looks more at kind of the give and take method. But it can actually re-victimize the victim, as there is that inherent power that the bully has too, and it's making both sides feel as if they're both at fault. So mediation is good for some conflict resolution where give and take is happening, but it is not appropriate where somebody is feeling victimized. And our last one is the most important that I'll leave you with. Follow the research. Research is ongoing and changing. We teach our students. Our students teach us. So we need to keep our eyes and ears open for all for new things that come out, new research that is available to us. We just took our first steps to learning, and it'll be a continuous journey.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Patricia. She's returning to us for definition and response.
The underlying philosophy supporting the behavioral matrix were to identify responses that allow students to learn from and correct their mistakes, to identify certain behaviors that can lead to more severe bullying behaviors, and to avoid the labeling of students. Our team have believed that the district's bullying prevention efforts will be more successful with consistency across all schools in definition of bullying, and interpretation of the severity of unacceptable behaviors and appropriate responses, and in required documentation, notification, and communication. The work of the definition and response to uncover emotional and subtle bullying behaviors in addition to physical bullying behaviors, as well as incorporated bullying behavior challenges posed by technology such as texting. The recommendations cover more ground than state requirements or the existing policy and establish enhanced requirements for documentation and notification. The definition and response team recommends that explicit definitions and behavioral matrices be used to train teachers and educate students and to be distributed to parents annually, preferably at the beginning of each new school year. May I add that all the interventions that I've mentioned aren't complete. Rather, they're just the beginning. We need intervention dialogue when bullying occurs, and it should include all bystanders, not to exclude any messenger bullies or others who could have helped in a positive way. Classroom teachers need to build community within the classroom through role-playing, discussions, and other activities, along with the parents at home. This positive attitude needs to be built from day one before the children can venture out and pay it forward to others in school and into the community.
Thank you, Patricia. John Bauer and Molly Manzella will present the school climate.
Going to meet in the middle. So I took a Decker communication course, and I was sworn whenever I do a presentation that I never read my slides. So I don't intend on reading my slides. I do urge you to read those slides that were presented to you, especially the packet. And we're focusing on one of the best practices, which is specifically school climate. And when we looked into kind of across the board, what did all the schools that really addressed bullying successfully have? It was they had those two components, safety and belonging. That's what the students felt when they were in those school environments. And so, well, how do we get there? What vehicles drive us there? Well, we looked at, again, across the board at the different schools that were doing it well, and it was through environment and through education. And Molly, I'll probably pass the ball off to you. You can kind of go into the specifics about that. And then I'll wrap up at the end kind of and talk to you a little bit about what specifically can we do to get there with creating that climate.
Well, a couple of the things, the key things that I wanted to take out of it is that we had a fairly comprehensive package here. The findings that we came up with regard to enhancing school climate and making it children feel more safe and having a sense of belonging. Specifically, with regard to bullying, we felt that one of the most important things that we could do was offer an anti-bullying class along the lines of the way the exploratory program is run with regard to health class. It's a mandatory class for all of the students, and it's revolving, so I mean, all of the students have to take it at one time or another during their year. For instance, basically, the social climate is changing. There's a lot more attention on bullying now. We read about it everywhere. It's in the media. And schools are probably going to be held accountable at some point for what's happening, if they've been notified, if things are going on, and they haven't taken steps to address it. And one of the things that we felt was the most important piece in this is to offer the children this class. It explains what is bullying. Instead of just conflict resolution, where there's sort of a give and take and children have to, like, either stay away from each other or work it out, a true inequity or imbalance of power, whether it's real or perceived, based on things such as gender, disability, sex, a lot of things. It could be a lot of things. But what we wanted to teach the children is what is it? What to do as a bystander? Where do you go when you need to report this? Are there safe ways to report this? There's no homerooms at Hadley. Who is the person that they should go to? Anonymous reporting. There are steps that we felt that the children, that everybody involved in the school climate, teachers, students, parents need to know, and everyone needs to know the responsibilities regarding this issue. That was one of them. We also felt that the school website should have a link which would include relevant information about bullying, as well as guidance for parents regarding steps to take when they observe bullying or they're afraid their own child is being bullied. For instance, could be easy as on the home page, a clip if your child's being bullied. Here's the Hadley policy or the District 41 policy. Here are the steps your child should take. Here are the things that you should be looking for. Here is our response. Here is our procedures to respond. And what you should do now, and probably some links or references to material that people can set, parents can study. We also felt that there should be instructional minutes within the curriculum to teach topics relevant to the social emotional learning standards. And we also felt that there should be alternatives to the lunchroom. There could be at each school a smaller, less chaotic environment, such as a place like the technology center, reading room, library time, a place where kids would go to read, to sort of get out of that fray if indeed that's too stressful for children.
So again, you may see a recurrent theme through most of the presentations here, and where that education component of it is crucial. Well, if you put yourself as an adult in a bullying situation, it's a really awkward, I'm not sure what to do situation. So again, the research has shown that part of our role as educators is to coach our students to how to address those situations. Well, as Mom mentioned, that's going to take some curriculum minutes to do that. That as a classroom teacher, that not only is it okay for me to teach that and to model that, but it's part of the curriculum. That it's part of our education system here as a district and within the schools. So if you look at some of the action items when you go to after the stakeholder slide, where it's, well, specific things on how to get there, some of those things may sound simplistic with modeling. Well, it might, as adults, well, man, this, you know, yeah, you should model good behavior. Well, it's very impactful for the students to receive that type of instruction. And that means possibly having work with the Klenberg West or high school students and come in and have kind of a peer modeling when they share stories or they have a bullying scenario on how to react. Because again, part of what I hear as a classroom teacher is, Mr. Bauer, I didn't know what to do. And I think that's a common reply in a very stressful, awkward situation for any child. And so again, if we can kind of model and coach and train kids within the classroom setting, we teach math, we teach English, we teach other important academic things. But we're finding, again, the bullying and the behavioral issues across the country are continuing to rise. So in order as a district to kind of buck that trend and be proactive with it, that's what we felt as a task force. These are some things that we can do all across the board, all across the schools, to make it better. And I think all of us want, I live in this community, I coach here, I teach here, I think everybody wants to feel safe and have a sense of belonging to their school. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our final group is Community Engagement Education, and Jeremy will do that presentation.
Good evening. Our group was charged with community engagement education. Basically, what we targeted were three main areas with that. What is the message to the community? What agencies are we going to align with? And how do we engage as many members of the community, being parents, students, businesses, and other members of the community to participate in these sort of events to get that message out? The message that we came up with was stand up and be heard. And that message obviously could be tweaked in any sort of future thing, but what we were really trying to identify is something that's broad enough that a number of businesses and community people could get behind, yet specific enough that it means something. You know, you would immediately know that that has something to do with, you know, being heard, having your voice being recognized. And what we identified through this, and I think, you know, a lot of people have mentioned so far, is the crucial role of the bystander. And, you know, really the bystander is the key component of de-escalating bullying, from the simple fact of telling somebody, having their voice heard, or strengthen numbers, and making that some sort of behavior that, you know, can be patterned and repeated. A number of the, you know, community partners that we identified with this message would be park district, governmental bodies, libraries, obviously schools, and businesses that, you know, could put up things that some sort of logo or recognition, you know, of this message, so it would be something that would be recognized within the community, and at least something that could be seen by not just students in schools, but, you know, as far as, you know, people in other areas and, you know, walks of life around the community, whether it's a business that has a poster or it's, you know, a library that has something in there, but something where families can engage. What we look at as far as engaging the community were a different number of things. And what we tried to target were, obviously, you know, the hardest part of this is getting the community to come out in response to this and, you know, be a part of this, and everybody has different sort of interests. So what we looked at were a number of different venues. We looked at something that would be more geared towards, you know, athletics, or something that would be a little more active, something you could hold in a gymnasium or in a park or something like that, kind of in a festival atmosphere, that would be, you know, geared towards, you know, a more active lifestyle, more active families. And whatever those activities are, you know, you surround them with local athletes or people in that sort of area, and it really has to do with sharing their experiences about bullying when they were a kid, or how they felt at times when they were in middle school. Something they can identify with, something that they can see that, you know, obviously somebody who's, you know, a celebrity or somebody who's, you know, a professional athlete or something of that nature, you know, has overcome a lot of these things. Another thing that we looked at was something that would be more of an artistic sort of fair, something that could revolve around, you know, drama or certain arts, or something that would be a little more in a different vein, and that would be something that would be geared towards perhaps libraries or things like that, where you could have local artists or authors, you know, who have touched on these things in their lives, and they could speak about these in some of their works. And you can have basically some sort of workshops afterwards with the kids, with the parents, if they so choose. Another thing that we thought of was, you know, something along the lines of maybe geared towards more parents, or maybe even little kids who maybe not comfortable with that sort of atmosphere. Kind of a symposium, maybe a more of a fate setting, something like that, where you'd have a number of speakers, and you can incorporate people who are experts in this field, do more of a question and answer sort of thing. You could have workshops afterwards, but it would be a little more geared towards kind of a more, I guess, intellectual approach, if you will. The other thing that we looked at was geared towards the school, and when I say school, I guess families and more than parents, in creating a universal website. And what we meant by that was creating a website that could be educational, you know, work for the parents, but also would have some sort of, you know, entertainment value in the sense that you grab the child. Now, whether they're in grade school or middle school, you know, we could use some sort of basic, kind of create a series around, or 2 to 3 minute episodes that would revolve around bullying, kind of something that could instigate discussion amongst the kids, might be something that grabs their attention, and then you can talk about that with teachers, parents can talk about that with their kids, but something that, you know, they wouldn't automatically turn off to. And it would be something that if it was engaging, they could come back to, you know, again and again to find out certain things. In that same sort of vein, this would be a website where parents, you know, could find links to other anti-bullying experts, people who are experts in their field. They could also chat with each other about best practices and what's working with their families and what's not. Kind of, you know, a community website that could, you know, not only engage the kids, but also engage the parents and hopefully engage them with community members and with their family all at the same time. Kind of a one-stop shop sort of website. And, you know, in that vein too, I mean, as far as, you know, the aspect of a universal website, if there was some sort of, you know, animated aspect or something like that, this could be something that middle school kids could actually make on their own at some point and turn it over to them, and that could be something that can kind of spur them to really look at it from themselves. They would be solving problems, they would be engaged with their, you know, classmates and kind of doing this on their own, just that one aspect of it. And that might be, you know, something that would be helpful for them. The other thing that we had discussed was having high school kids, you know, come to middle schools and talk about their experiences, you know, leaders and different aspects of high school and the things that, you know, they've overcome. And you know, not just athletes, but, you know, all sorts of people in a wide variety of ways, and share their experiences. You know, and we think, I mean, between these two things, I mean, there's a number of different things that, you know, they can engage, you know, different members of the community. The website, you know, will be designed for everybody, but also for people who aren't going to come out to any one of those other four, you know, aspects. But we really think with something like that, that has a lot of different parameters to it, especially having, you know, unfortunately in this day and age with celebrities or athletes, you know, people will come out for that. That would also be an opportunity for businesses to really support it in the sense that, you know, they can participate and, you know, get the message out, but at the same time get their own logos out and, you know, and have their own recognition. But they could provide a lot of entertainment for putting up these events in exchange for doing that sort of thing. So in a nutshell, that's what we did.
Thank you. And Jeremy's going to share the next step recommendations as well.
And now, Jeremy Barnett. next steps and recommendations. The administration should continue to use the framework of the study group topics to develop action plans that encompass each school and the district administration. Two, the administration should determine appropriate outreach to our community partners to assist in raising awareness in the community. Obviously, as far as policy changes, anything that hopefully would reflect any sort of change in policy through this would also be looked at in the culture of care. The parent-teacher advisory board should be a response matrix to determine how it fits to the overall discipline matrix. A communication plan should be developed to highlight the work of the task force and outline next steps for action. And finally, as the best practices study group advised, you know, all the research, which means develop a systematic approach to collecting data around intervention, prevention practices employed would be current with the, I would involve in our place around bullying. That's, in a nutshell, our next step recommendations. And I'd just like to take an opportunity to thank everybody for all their work and sitting here listening today to each and every one of you. It's been great to do, and I hope that a lot of these things help outline next practices and obviously any sort of policy measures and anything along those lines. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy. Has a chance to weigh in on this. One of the things that I'd just like to note, two things. What you probably noticed and was a natural outcome of this work was that the best practices group, which worked in its own group, the climate group worked in its own group, community engagement and education worked in its own group, and the response and definition worked in its own group. But when you heard the set of best practices, what you heard afterwards was all of the work that the other groups did around best practices, even though they hadn't heard from the first group about those best practices. And so that synergy overlapping the work really was not only holistic but specific in and of itself. And I don't think we could have planned it any better in terms of the outcome, that everything that people highlighted for you today really showed up in the research when the best practices work was done. And that was a natural outgrowth of just great work on the part of all of the committees. What Patricia didn't outline for you, because but it is in the board's notebook, is the actual matrix that group developed around responses, behaviors and responses, which will be shared with the parent-teacher advisory, but it's a very comprehensive examination of how we might become consistent in our approach towards behaviors that we find unacceptable. So I just wanted to put that caveat in there because it's a fabulous piece of work that they created through a lot of consensus building, right? So, board questions or comments?
That was one of them when I looked at the matrix under definition and response, is that what you're referring to, was that this was either updated from practice or this was all new information that you had gleaned from your resources. It's terrific. And I like the way it cascades because, you say reality check, right? If ineffective, you move to this level. There are some reactive pieces, of course, because we need to catch it. But I like the fact that the behaviors are named. I think that for kids and for parents, too, we need to be really concrete so that they understand that. So that was, you answered one of my questions. I think a lot of this is really planting seeds as well. You know, when I look through the board packet that we got and had a chance to think a little bit about it, I was reflecting back on the in-service that the seventh graders had at Hadley on the 21st President's Day when we were in school, and my son's in seventh grade. And when he came home and talked about that, a lot of the conversation was around recognizing how these external visitors really captured some of what goes on in the school periodically and how do we then take a stand and how hard that is for them as children, to all your points. But I do think that's reinforcing, and so I like this idea of this core, yet another core extension perhaps, but that's consistent for kids so that they build a level of acumen around this and language and a sensitivity to the behaviors, and then they get stronger by eighth grade, hopefully, so that they go into West. And I was chatting with Christine and Jeremy over here. I have a daughter that's a senior in high school, and there isn't a week that goes by that she doesn't come home and talk about bullying issues in the high school. So while I've never met an adult who answered the question I'm going to pose affirmatively, and that is, so would you ever redo junior high again? I've not met a single person that says, yes, I'd love to go through seventh grade again. They may have fond memories of a teacher or an experience or something, and that's always my hope with our junior high, that there'll be pockets. But the reality is it's a really, really challenging time for all the reasons that we talked about, which is why the learner characteristics are so important and these behaviors become so important. So the two comments I would make is, number one, Dan and I talked about this across the board table with Ann at the last meeting, and that was that the policy committee on which he and I serve is going to look at Section 7, which houses the bullying policy that you have in here. So know that we're moving on to that for our next section review so that we can, you know, make sure we're up to speed and can take this into consideration. And then I thought about the Board of Education, you know, so what's ours? You have us listed in here, and we've got a paragraph, and I was really glad to see that we're being held to standards as well. We have a code of conduct. It's actually up on the door there above the no smoking sign, which is also a code of conduct. And that's the law, right. And, you know, when board members are elected and we have our transition meeting, we sign this code of conduct, and there are elements of it that really speak to behavior. And our ability to have, you know, a team and collaboration and civil discussion and all those pieces, we have to model that. So I was glad to see that in here and that this could be a board goal for us as we move forward and think about goals for next year. And then, you know, you spoke about this a little bit, and this is rhetorical, but, you know, what's our responsibility as we live and work in these communities that make up District 41 to address behavior that we would identify or define as bullying, whether it's between two parents at a soccer game or, you know, parents talking about a teacher in a way that's disparaging, or a teacher saying something about a student that's not in the best light, and we overhear that. You know, what's our collective responsibility to appropriately address that? And I think, as you said, this conversation is so fluid now and also so, like, omnipresent across the country. I'm proud that we had that many people come forward from the community and from our staff and administration to want to, you know, do the work of it. So I think as a board, we have our work to do as well. One quick question. Did any of the study groups, maybe it was under research, was there any information around cultural influences in populations and how they react similarly or differently to aspects of bullying if they've been attacked in a bullying way? Are there cultures that would withhold that information from parents for any particular reason? I wondered if there was anything that you found that would address some of that as our population, you know, shifts in some ways culturally as well. Yeah, just curious. I think, you know, that's always a piece.
I think the climate group did some work around making sure that you recognize the demographics of your community,
yeah,
and make sure that you're inclusive, mm-hmm, in the activities and in the representations that you have.
Yeah.
It could come up in a discussion.
Yeah. And then the last thing I'll just close with, along with a thank you, is there is a program, and we've talked about it and publicly too, that Dr. Dranzoff started, which is the Best Buddies program at Hadley. And in fact, Casey, Molly's son, and my son are buddies in a little buddy family. And I love the idea that we make this an overt, you know, expression of connection, because I do think, I've heard so many speakers about rearing children, right? And they say, well, you know, parenting is over by 12 or 13, which is a scary thought, you know, to the extent that they actually listen to us. And so the sooner we dive into this, you know, the stronger that those contacts, and the more they'll look out for each other. So thank you.
First of all, I have to be honest. When this task force was beginning and names were coming out, I really wasn't sure what to expect, because as a parent, you know, this word bullying is so prevalent in our schools that what does it really look like? When my third grader comes home and tells me somebody called her a bully, and I'm like, okay, well what's happened? And it's a little discouraging sometimes, because the word bully, they don't understand what it necessarily means. So to hear this presentation and you talk about a definition and a consistent definition to be communicated to the students, to the staff, to the community, to that's what is important, because one of the things I think our district has really made great strides at doing is making consistency in our district, that buildings are all saying the same thing. It may look a little different depending on your building, but we're all modeling the behavior, we're using the same definition, so wherever you go, you know what that means. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, going through this and taking a look at it over the weekend, I have all these little notes, and as you guys were all talking, many of my questions and comments were being heard and being answered. A couple of things, though, that I just questions, thoughts that I had in terms of the reporting system. I know often people just think of bullying and they kind of believe, think of older kids, yet we know that that's not the case. I'm sure, you know, it starts at a young age, and not so much that it starts at, that that's the intention of a small child, but that their behavior is not corrected. It's not identified, it's not corrected. They're not being taught the skills, you know, maybe they're being taught at school, but they're not being reinforced in their homes. And I think that that's one of the things that, as a parent, we hear the stories of, you know, the parent makes the phone call, the school makes the phone call, and that parent of the bully, or the alleged bully, I call everybody alleged as a lawyer, but the alleged bully, you know, the parent doesn't take it seriously. The parent says, oh, not my little Johnny or Susie, they're perfect and wonderful, and they would never do those kinds of things. Yet, you in the schools, the victim's parent is like, what are you talking about? I witnessed it. These people have seen it. You're not listening. So it's the education component that really hit home. But again, I'm going to go back to the consistency in the reporting system. I know at Hadley they've had, you know, anonymous, and the entering take 10, you know, you could fill out a form, but yet often the kids didn't feel like it was really anonymous, because it was an incident between one or two students, and then when that student was brought down to the assistant principal's office and the conversation would go on, you know, sometimes that would escalate the situation, because then that child would go back. So I, you know, some of these reporting systems, it's going to be interesting from you all, or what were some of the ones that you found to be, seem to be more successful at any age level?
I guess I can start off. In the more in-depth report, the PBIS system, mm-hmm, is addressed in there, which kind of integrates with, you know, kind of our bully task force,
right,
and some of the best practices. And one of the things that's come about, I believe Ben Franklin's using one, we're using one, there's an actual, there's, you know, I hate to use the term discipline form, but there's an incident form,
okay,
that we are putting in practice now that is very specific with what the behavior was. And if it happens at lunch, or it happens in the classroom, or if it happens anywhere within the school environment, if a student goes to any adult and brings this up, then the students that are involved with it, basically interviewed, and then, you know, the fact-finding kind,
right,
of goes through, and if it's felt that, you know, this is a consistent pattern, there's a write-up. But again, that's where we need to be consistent procedurally, so that, okay, what is three times by that same student mean? And then what is the district or our school consequence for when that happens? But so we've started some things in place to be consistent, and the student, the great thing so far is the students are starting to see this. And I had a very unscientific report from my students that I shared with our group, that the students feel sometimes when they're at lunch or they're at recess, when it's not a classroom teacher or it's not the principal, when they go to an adult, their words were, they don't think anything ever happens. And they're already starting to see now that things are happening, and that, you know, there is some follow-up with it, and there is some procedure in place. So again, are we where we want to be? No. But I think those types of things where we can keep moving ahead with, and again, PBIS will be integrated with that, because that's part of, you know, part of the consequence system of the PBIS.
Well, and I think as a parent who is a student in a building, you know, I think, are we all with PBIS?
Everybody will be in the fall.
Okay.
Totally.
And because I've been at Ben Franklin, this is the second year that we've done, so we, and the kids, again, it's the consistency, it's the repetition to that, and it's the, I mean, they can tell you about it. And my hope as a parent, as a community member, as a board member, is that it becomes part of their day-to-day without them ever thinking about it, that it's just instilled in them that this is how we behave. That said, I realize that my experience, and it may be different than others, but I have been very impressed, and I've talked to other parents from Hadley who have been very impressed with the strides of the of feeling of sense of belonging at Hadley, of having those teachers, whether it's not necessarily their take time, but it's somebody in that building that they feel connected to. It's easier to feel that in elementary because you have that classroom teacher, there's somebody. Again, not everybody has had that necessarily, that same experience. The other thing that I've noticed that I wonder if you've seen in the research or just anecdotally in your discussions, that transition from fifth grade to sixth grade, and students maybe starting the year in sixth grade feeling really good, this is my chance to get away from these kids, and then all of a sudden they're in a situation that they've never learned the right skills of how to remove themselves, how to stand up for themselves, or more importantly, the bystander. And that was something that you guys repeated a number of times, is the bystander. Because in addition to the, you know, the bully or the victim, it's the six kids or two kids or one child that's standing there watching it happen and not saying a word. And you listen to what goes on the buses, and everybody sits there and they all hear it and they say nothing. So how do you educate the bystanders to stand up and say, enough is enough, this is a night, whether it's anonymous reporting some way to say that it happened, how do you educate the bystanders?
Well, I think that's part of the work that this group, you know, the work that they did was very foundational, and charging the next group
to
begin to develop the action plans. What will the consistency look like? What will we expect in the fall that is the singular message? And so we didn't ask them to come up with a solution.
I understand that. I just was, you know, again, you guys are looking at it, talking about it, kind of living and breathing it in a way that, you know, we look at something from an anecdotal perspective, from our own personal experiences or the experience of a friend. Just curious as to what was, you know, things that you might have seen in your research and in your discussions.
Well, one of the things that we discussed and what John actually touched upon was in this class, this would be something of like a exploratory, mm-hmm. and the equivalent of the health class. Everybody has to take it. Not only what is bullying, but what are the roles of the people involved, the bystander, the bully, the person being bullied, and what do you do about it? You know, there will always be children that just don't have the emotional maturity to confront someone. Mm-hmm. But there are other ways, and this is the kind of thing that they need to be instructed about, and as John was saying, that, you know, knowledge is power. What we need to do with the children is actually train them on how to verbally deal with someone who's bullying, mm-hmm. for themselves and for other people. You know, the world is full of people that will take advantage of someone else. It's in the workplace, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. The simple best thing you can do is arm children with what they need, the power to give them the permission to speak up, to say something, and to encourage it, and teach them how to do it.
Are there other questions?
To piggyback that too, I think in addition to the education, it's that sense of trust across the board. Like the students have to trust us, and then there's a time element. I mean, again, equated to a corporate job. You've got a boss that's got a zillion things on their platter, and you keep going to them. You've got this really important issue that needs to be addressed. And it's, you know, okay, you know, I'll get back to you. And again, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I've only talked for 5 years. My cup is runneth over with my accountability. So we do have to take a breath and make sure that we are allowing that classroom time to create that community of care where the kids trust that when they know they go to me, then I'm going to kind of follow up with it. That they can trust me as their teacher. They did everything I told them to do to come to me with it. And so now, again, we have to have those times in the day when they're going to be able to do that with us. And again, that could be whether again, that's where it kind of goes all across the board. Maybe the student feels a good, really, you know, close relationship, like with our, you know, Donna Keller office manager. It doesn't matter which adult it is. It's that trust factor.
Can you mentioned some of the things that are done at Lincoln, and I've heard drifting home some anti-bullying language for my Lincoln kids. As far as what's been recommended here as best practices and things like that, around the district, is each school kind of doing its own thing right now, or are we... I know parts of this is already being implemented or being used, right? So I'm kind of trying to get a sense of what's going on right now in the district. And then most of my questions were around next steps and what's the timeline for coalescing a district-wide policy. But as far as what's out there right now, are we doing some of these things now?
And if I can answer that, since each of them represent a different school and not all of the schools, I think PBIS is the unifying piece right now for all of our schools, and they're at different places in that development and the implementation.
Would you tell people what the acronym is, just in case?
Positive Behavior Intervention Strategies. Strategies. And so it is a way of using a positive approach, a restorative approach to helping students manage their behavior, as well as focusing on what do we believe as a building. What do we believe about how we want to treat one another, how we behave, and those kinds of things. Franklin was a pilot school for us 2 years ago, and so they're a little further along than all the other schools are, but everyone is in at least the preliminary stages and being trained in PBIS is a very formalized program. And so everyone will be up and running with PBIS in the fall, and that'll be a consistency. So added to that would be whatever next steps approach comes out of the work that's next. And there will be another request for participation to actually take this work and develop the next step protocol so that when we start our school year next year, that singular message can be utilized. Hopefully the behavior and response matrices will be implemented in alignment with the our already disciplined matrix. That's why Parent Teacher Advisory really wants to take a look at that and weigh in on that as well. So I would say the timeline for some of this work is the fall. And then some of this work, like the work of community engagement and education, is probably work that would unfold over the course of next year as we find community partners and with whom to engage. And we've begun some preliminary conversations with our intergovernmental partners to do so. But there are many other partners, as that group has indicated, and opportunities. So I think we'd focus internally first, mm-hmm. and then begin to look at how do we take that message to a broader audience, the community.
So the training for teachers is already on the docket for...
Well, the training for teachers has to be embedded in the next steps plan.
Right now, only the committee... have been trained.
Yeah. For PBIS.
Mm-hmm. Not all the staff members.
Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the key things about PBIS, and I don't know how much everybody knows, but is that hidden curriculum per se, that some people, and I think you hit on it really well, like that we need to arm the children with how it is we expect them to behave and how to do that. And PBIS is doing that in general with behaviors, whether it be how do you behave in a lunchroom, how do you behave in the bathroom, how do you behave in the hallway, and on the buses, because we expect every student to know how to behave appropriately, kindly, respectfully, especially with different cultures and demographic changes that we have going on, is not realistic. And so I think with PBIS already, it's just, you know, that perfect timing. It's already being implemented, and now we've got the bullying piece to add to that. It's, you know, the teachers are going to be trained in how to train kids to say what they need to say, do what they need to do, you know, behave the way they're supposed to behave, and I think it's going to be very synergistic, all going to come together very well.
And I think to begin the year, the message that's consistent and unified has to be a simple message. so that, you know, kids are hearing it from the very beginning all the way through, and it's not overly complex. I mean, I think your teachers here will tell you when they build classroom rules, they don't build them with 15, 20 rules. It's, you know, it's simpler, and that we can be consistent about.
And all the building teams have kind of worked together when we've gone to training. We have the same three overarching rules.
Mm-hmm.
Say, be responsible, be respectful. And then we're kind of defining behaviors in the areas in the same, in a similar fashion,
mm-hmm.
whether they're early childhood or an eighth grader. And so we've done a lot of sharing across the district and between buildings, trying to, you know, create some consistency,
mm-hmm.
so that when they, when our students come from the elementary into the junior high, they're not learning a whole new set. It's just rolling it into a new environment.
Can I ask a question on the, in your best practices, you talk a lot about, you talk about the ability to anonymously identify something like this, bystander to the kid that's being bullied. Is there anything about confidentiality in the sense of best practice? It just seems to me that, you know, if you're a kid that's getting slammed against a locker when you walk between third and fourth period and you report it, well, then the person that's been bullying you knows that you're the one reporting it and could lead to other, you know, repercussions or behavior, you know, a higher level, go to level 3 or 4 because of that. Is there anything in the best practices is how do you rat somebody out without, you know, really being identified as the person that did it? Is there anything you guys found in the best practice on how to do that?
One of the things is an anonymous hotline that some school districts are actually using, so you can call it in.
Yeah, the anonymous part I get, right? It's
the repercussion,
I mean,
after
I'm reporting.
There's always an assumption.
I'm reporting
terror
after bullying.
But it may not be. But the person who reports may not be the victim. It is difficult to make sure that in the immediate follow-up that the victim doesn't become further victimized. And that may have to do with the immediacy of response,
mm-hmm.
to the hotline message or whatever anonymous reporting that there may be.
Yeah, it seems like timing could be one thing, or how the person is approached in the investigation. I don't know. I'm just wondering if you guys had any...
I mean, just think of a teacher. We've had this situation occur, and, you know, we're put on high alert. You know, now we need, like, if you reported that mean guy over there, you know, we need to watch out for you then. We need to make sure that you're not alone in the hallway, but there's a teacher watching you get from one class to another. There's a teacher watching you get to the lunchroom and to the bathroom, you know, and that the locker rooms are, you know, that's really where it's such a personal job, you know. It's not about just in general watch out for the kids, but, you know, John's in trouble, he's taken that step, we're proud of him, but, you know, everyone's going to know who did it. If John was the one being bullied by those five kids, everyone knows John's the one who reported them,
right.
And so now we need to keep our eye on you and make sure that you're safe. And until things get taken care of, and they put you to the next step. And, you know,
that sounds like an interesting strategy of put on alert so that you can catch the person doing it.
Or just,
then,
you know, even though maybe even those kids have been caught.
Yeah.
But now that they don't, you know, seek revenge upon you, we have to just make sure as best we can that you're not left vulnerable.
The other thing, and I think this is great, I appreciate you guys taking the time to do this, but one of the things, and I just may have missed it because I didn't read it cover to cover, but there's a lot in here about behaviors and the responses for the person that bullied. But, you know, what about the responses, you know, when I read some of these things in terms of, you know, stalking another student? Well, I get the responses and the actions to the bully. What about that person that was stalked for that time? And what are the responses or the responsibility we might have to that student to help them get over that? And really, you know, I don't know, being bullied, you know, there's this power imbalance you guys talked about. You know, how do you make someone feel more confident that they have maybe a power that they don't perceive they had, so they're willing to be bullied? I don't know what the answer is, but it seems like something on the side of what do you do to the person that was bullied and what were the responses to that. Could be something to think through in terms of how we take this next step. It's not just the bully person, right? Suspension, fill out the form, but what about the person that was bullied? Just a thought.
And I think our social workers here probably could give you some insights into what they currently do, but it is one of the more complicated areas because there isn't, and I'll let, you know, Heather and Jenny, and there isn't a single protocol for how to deal with the individual who's been victimized, partly because every individual is so different and their needs are different. But I don't know if
yeah, I mean, we can still have kind of a recommended response for, I mean, even just a call to the parent to say, you know, is there anything we can do to help? I don't know. To show that there's a care for the person that's bullied.
I think that's where the education of the teachers comes in. If an educator would go ahead along with other educators, because we consider all the children to be our children, we all come together like mother hens and we are watching our children.
Or father.
Father rooster.
Give it, we'll give you a rooster.
But you're all watching and you're all taking care of each other, you're watching that child, and you are making those phone calls. Excuse me, that's the communication piece. You are working with the social worker. That child just does not get lost in this.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not suggesting that at all. It's just that as we go to formalize this, maybe an additional column that says, you know, what is the response required for the person that we bullied? Right. Just something that formalizes it.
Early in the victim, separately. But sort of a follow-up to make sure that
the
comes down and
that they feel more confident. I mean, I would think there's just such a confidence. You know, your confidence is shattered when that happens to you. Like, you know, you
well, it's
sure.
Almost like there should be a form for that. Like, when was the last time they were checking in with how was the response? 3 months, you know, three weeks later.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
As we do it for academics, we should be able to do it for social and emotional things as well, if that's needed. Right.
It's just adding another column to the work you guys did say.
I'll send that on to the next group. This group did commit to the further work.
There's no eighth meeting.
There's no eighth meeting, that's
correct. Thank you very much.
Even if it's a challenge or something.
I do a lot of team-based projects, and one of the interesting things in there is when you have a teammate that's fallen down, usually the best motivator is not the boss or the big stakeholder, but your fellow teammates. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to see some parallels here. You're talking about probably the best way to discourage us or help out is the students, and I'm assuming that comes through the culture or helping the students understand how to do that. So I'm always trying to look for ways to avoid instead of fix it later. So I think that's pretty cool. I can see you guys looking at the time.
I want to thank the task force for putting this together. It's an impressive document that you've put together. From my standpoint, kind of reading through it, I start thinking, okay, well, what, you know, as a board member, you know, what are the board's next steps? I mean, I think Eric had talked on it, and she hadn't mentioned it. I would have said, you know, let's get the policy recommendations into the policy committee for incorporation into school policy. I'm very impressed, and I think everyone should be applauded for this hard work. And this took a lot of time and effort to put this all together. I had just one question, and it was something that was mentioned in the presentation, and I'm not sure what the concept is, and it's the concept of the messenger bullet. Oh, somebody could explain that to me.
We talk about that a lot in class. Back up a little bit when you're talking about, first of all, a fifth grade teacher, some of the power that can address that. Now, all the work into what you're talking about is here.com. We prepare the fifth graders very much, especially at, well, I don't know about other schools, I'm sure they do too, but Lincoln. We work with them as leaders, and we build a community from the very beginning, very first day of school, you know, 3 weeks in and meetings every week. And we teach them, you know, how to model good behavior for the little ones that they're around. And, you know, just if their friends are in trouble, what do? And messenger boy is the child who's standing over here
and it has a fight with someone over there, and there's that child with a little bit of, you know, I want to say they're a little weak as far as saying, what do I do now? And they say, well, go over there and tell them that I'm not going to play with them. And then they run over there and they say, they're not going to play with you. Will you tell her? Blah, blah, blah. And they go back and forth, back and forth. We talk about that a lot in class, the messenger bully, not to be one of those children, but those are the bystanders, too, mm-hmm. that could have turned the situation into more of a positive outcome.
Mm-hmm. So. Thank you. All right, just my comment for your next group, too, before I forget, our bus drivers. I know they're not our employees, but how do you get the bus drivers to report the nonsense that goes on the bus? Because they know, they see it, they hear it, they're looking at it in their little mirror up top. They are, you know, they're the bystander who sits and does nothing, some of them. I'm sure others perhaps can help. How do you incorporate them into all of this? Because to me, they are a key component to making a child feel safe on the bus.
Well, it seems like they have, you know, like a classroom code of conduct, you know, a bus code.
There is a bus code of conduct.
A lot of stuff that, I mean.
And we've been working this year with our lunchroom supervisors. I believe there's another workshop scheduled April for working with them. And we've talked about the bus drivers. Obviously, we'll have to see what arrangements we could make with the transportation company, how to compensate them. They're not going to come to training, you know. But absolutely. I mean, if we had our own transportation system, that would be a given.
Right.
And if we had our own, working with a contract, obviously there are probably some other issues we'd have to work through. But I think you're right, Tara. It's another important component that they're on the same page as we are.
Well, at the beginning of the year, two building principals, that mm-hmm. was our bus drivers, just to kind of create that personal contact with them, to let them know kind of what we expect of our students when they're on the bus, and if they're not reacting that way, not behaving that way, that we want to know about it. So we encourage them to report things to us, and we tell them that we're there to support them, because we want, they're the first person to greet that child mm-hmm. in the morning and the last one to send them home on their way home. And so we want both experiences, the arrival to school and the bus trip home, to be, you know, safe and a happy place to be, and that we're there to support them should they have difficulties mm-hmm. with the drive to or from school.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I know
that was a big step last year, meeting with the bus drivers and doing that outreach initially and continuous contact throughout the year to try to. But giving them some skills that they may not have would also be a good next step.
Well, and empowering them as well, because I think that sometimes that there's stuff that, you know, they feel they can't, you know, they can't do or they can do,
right.
And, you know, what kind of discipline and talking in school, but, you know, it could be potentially empowering for them as well to know how to handle mm-hmm. these situations.
It might be something that we'd want to write into the next RFP when 87 and the everybody goes out for bid to include training in, you know, let them know they've got their drivers will have to attend X hours of training on whatever we decide, mm-hmm. right?
We've built, just to answer that question, we've built into this latest bid document the ability for us to meet as a team, District 89, 87, 41, as well as a successful bidder for monthly, quarterly meetings to discuss any broad ranging topics we may have out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I've been reading the RFP is good, but I think it's got to be a little more concrete than just training. It should be, I mean, how many reports of bullying do we get from the bus drivers every year?
Well, it would be referrals that go into the school. That would be our data point.
I've got
more than five?
Sure. I'm sure there's more than five.
And mostly they occur at the junior high.
So maybe it's not just training, but a form that, mm-hmm.
They do have a form. I mean, they have
a set of protocols.
They have a set of protocols, and it's just a matter of whether they feel comfortable using them, whether there's you know, whether they take the initiative to report. There is a training component just to make sure, and then I think the meetings, staying in closer contact with them, so that we hear what they're experiencing.
Can I say one thing? I think I can hear that they're driving. Concentrating on that, if your children have before, and if ever there was a need for volunteers to help explain and sit on the bus, maybe we can't pay them, but
Agree.
No, I agree. I think.
I don't know. I can't imagine they were hired too long.
No, but when the nastiness is going on and the kids are getting on the bus and throwing things, I mean, when things are being thrown around in the bus or kids are being, you know, four across in the bus, I think a bus driver should be able to look at that at the next stop and say, hey, by the way, you got to move. I think, it's more than just driving. It's still the bus safety.
Well, and again, we work with a company.
Right.
They're not our employees, so there are, you know, it's an important topic that we're certainly happy to look into as part of this over. The whole picture.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Well, thank you so much. For giving up so much time.
This was
their
eighth meeting.
This was their eighth meeting. That's right. It's almost as long as your other meeting. So thank you for staying as long as you did. Great job. Everything was clean. Carolyn's blonde? No. She didn't.
Thank you so much. Okay, we'll move on to the long-range technology plan.
Mike is going to share with you the long-range technology plan. I think he's given you glimpses, or at least Finance Committee has had glimpses of this report over time, but this is the fine-tuned, well-honed technology plan, and Mike's going to present to you over the next several minutes.
Okay, I'm going to start with school history. I first came to Glen Ellyn 9 years ago now. We had modest but efficient little enterprise here. At that time, the model in the grade school was a single computer in the classroom that was mainly for the teachers to use. Connected to a TV, and they had a printer in there, and there was also a switch in the room to gain access to the network and other network resources. We had a single firewall in the district that was basically heavily secure protection, and a single router for internet access. The one key component to our network is the fiber backbone that we had at that time. I think it was probably about 10 years ago when Cindy Heidorn was the business manager there. She implemented this fiber backbone that we currently still utilize. And that connects all our classrooms as well as connecting all of our buildings, which we're able to continue to leverage even today. It's a truly expandable solution for our district, and really a brilliant move on her part. Today, we've grown a little bit. So, for 9 years, we've got quite a bit more technology on the board. Currently, our model in the grade schools is K through third grade. There's three PCs in the room, one for the teacher and two for student use. Fourth grade has four, fifth grade has five. At the junior high, it can be a mix of PCs. It's really kind of all over the board at the junior high right now. And varying ages of computers as well. There's printers everywhere in this district, so you can't sneeze without hitting a printer in this district. They're in every classroom, sometimes two in that classroom. Switching equipment has expanded as the district has expanded. We've got more classrooms, we've got portables, we've got additional rooms at the junior high, so that has forced us, as well as the additional equipment, has forced us to put more backbone equipment in. We've expanded to two firewalls now, one for email and one for web access, in anticipation of greater access to our network, both internally and externally. People are going to need access to resources here. We put our web server on a different firewall and our email server on a different firewall, also for redundancy, failover, and protection. We've added web servers. We've got in-house web servers now. We've got in-house voice over IP service for phones. In-house email. We have remote access for staff currently. But we continue to leverage that fiber backbone. And when we did our switching upgrade last year, that fiber backbone is expandable to increase our bandwidth 10 times within the classrooms and 4 times within the buildings. So it's still a critical piece to our network there. Over the last few years, we've strengthened our backbone, our infrastructure. After 10 years, things are starting to get a little old, they're a little antiquated, it doesn't provide us the same amount of bandwidth transfer rate that we're going to need to support the new technology that we want to roll into our district. So a couple of years ago, we refreshed all of our switching equipment. A lot of that was 10, 12 years old. When we purchased that, it was purchased new. So it was not going to give us the kind of bandwidth that we're going to need to support the technology that we're going to roll out. So like I said, we were able to increase our bandwidth by tenfold within the classrooms. We refreshed our web servers last summer, we refreshed those. Again, in anticipation of the workload that they're going to need to take on, with all of the external traffic that we're going to have, whether it's parent or staff, getting to our network resources from outside, as well as staff that use the websites that we have internally. So to be able to bolster that so it's able to handle that kind of traffic. We refreshed our web servers, our phone servers. It's a critical piece of equipment that we have on the network. Phones are obviously a critical component to our network for safety and communication. We upgraded our backup solution. The more technology that we have on the domain here, the more we need to have backups. So we've also put redundant backups over at the junior high. So we've got backup solution here, backup solution at the junior high. We rarely, if ever, lose any data from our being able to recover those new backups. Like I said before, we've upgraded our firewall. We did that a couple of years ago. They're actually going to be doing a little fresh in about a year. And we also upgraded our UPS, and that's the uninterrupted battery source or power source for our core equipment in each building. And for our core equipment here, as well as the generator that we have here. And we actually got the use out of that a couple times just the past week since we lost power. One day in the middle of the school day. And I'm happy to say it worked perfectly. It worked just as designed. Out in the buildings, they had no idea we had lost power here until we called them and told them. So they were able to continue using email, web services, network services. Nothing was lost. So it worked just as we designed it to.
Mike,
yes, sir.
Can I just ask a quick question? What's your definition of switch?
Switch?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a PBX switch or what are we talking about?
Most of the classrooms have what we call like an edge switch.
Okay.
And it's not dissimilar to one you might even have in your home.
So it's like a routing switch.
Right.
Okay.
It doesn't route really, but it does handle any traffic within the building in a smart way.
Right. Okay.
So
I just seemed like 180 switches.
It's a lot. And it was basically the initial network design had placed a switch in every room.
Mm-hmm.
It's not how I would have designed it, but that's what we have. So rather than ripping out the infrastructure and trying to find a closet somewhere in the building, which can be a challenge just all by itself, we kind of left that structure in place.
Okay. That's where I was going to go next. Okay. All right.
And I think we showed this at the Finance Committee earlier in the school year. It's our refresh cycle. We put together an Agent Obsolescence Plan about a year or two ago. And this is just sort of a document that we refer to at least a couple times a year, and it helps us to plan for any refresh cycle that we're going to have. And this is for critical equipment that we have on the network that we know over time is going to need to be replaced. So it helps us develop a strategy for that, as well as to be able to budget for it and anticipate it coming. This document is also can be changed. I mean, this has been set in stone. As things change, demands change, we may accelerate the process, we may push it back, it may come off altogether if we can consolidate some of the equipment. So, like I said, this is basically a document to help us plan. So the first phase, which is this year, is our junior high is due for hardware refresh. And for the 11-12 school year, the first thing we did at the beginning of the year is develop a technology focus group that consisted of our department chairs at the junior high. And the common theme that came out of that group was access to technology and availability to technology. And just plain, it just isn't enough technology at the junior high to accommodate the need for it. So we kind of looked at strategies that we can go about replacing and upgrading, elevating the levels of technology that we have there. What we have there right now, it's like I said, it's a mix. And some of these machines are 5, even 10 years old. Some of those machines are the machines I put in the first year I was here. So, I mean, they're pretty old machines, and they're barely getting by. So what we recommend is an implementation of netbooks. So that's kind of a small form factor. It looks like this. It's capable enough to take care of web access, research, doing any kind of office suite documentation. It's perfectly capable of doing that. These have come a long way in the last couple of years from being able to handle this kind of lower-level processing, but a lot of what happens in Virginia, whether it's getting research off the internet, doing a paper in Word, or working on a spreadsheet, they're perfectly capable of doing that, and it's a little, much lower price point than the laptops we currently purchase. Not to mention being smaller, we can get as many as 20 of those in a pretty compact cart that can be moved from room to room and be available pretty much anywhere in the building. So, with space being at a premium on our classrooms, to be able to move all of these big bulky desktops that are currently just taking up room in a lot of these classrooms, this will be a nice solution to be able to free up some of that space in the rooms and make it more accessible and portable for our students and staff. We're also going to replace the desktop technology. In each classroom, you have at least one desktop that's going to manage mostly your AV equipment. So your smart board, your projector, your speakers, and it would be the main source for the teacher in that classroom as well. There's an email for working on any kind of documents that they need to work on, and web access, just your general day-to-day kind of processing that they need to do on the computer. But we pretty much stick with just a single PC in these rooms. Again, it frees up space. And for the most part, for teacher use, that would be sufficient. We're also going to plan a smart board rollout. Smart boards have been around for a while. It's kind of a tried new technology. It works. It's been successful in a lot of other districts. And most of the districts around us have already implemented smart boards. I know Lombard has them. Did a big rollout a couple of years ago. PD has smart boards. So they've been around for a while. They do work. And I feel comfortable going with a relatively large-scale rollout throughout the district. And we've identified the math and science classrooms initially for smart boards, and they probably get the most benefit out of them right away, as well as rolling out at the grade schools. We'd like to do two smart boards per grade level. This way, it also gives teachers an opportunity to collaborate within that grade level and also for support. We're going to begin to pilot some of the pad technology. Pad technology is kind of exploding onto the scene now. Everybody's got some kind of touchscreen pad technology that's coming out, tablet technology. So iPads, the Verizon Galaxy is another tablet technology. Motorola Zoom is coming out. These things are coming out so quickly, though, they're not really quite a finished product. The iPad is probably about the most polished that you're going to find, and even they're going to have a new model coming out within a month. It's twice as powerful, it has better a screen, has more memory. So I couldn't see doing a big investment in that kind of technology as it's changing so quickly, and we're really not quite sure how it's going to fit in on a broader scale, but we do want to pilot. And Scott Clespin at Church has already got 20 we have in-house now that we can start piloting. But we want to start rolling those out to each classroom and each building on a kind of limited basis, maybe about 10 or 15 per building. So we can start to see what potential we have with those, and also to see how that technology evolves and how it's going to work in with our curriculum.
He's got 20 iPads?
We just got 20. Yeah.
20 iPads.
20 iPads. And we've also got a Verizon Galaxy that we're testing and piloting just here. And then we'll look at the Motorola Zoom as soon as that comes out as well. With all of this wireless technology, we're going to need to reinforce our coverage, our wireless coverage at Virginia High. So, there's going to be rolling out some more access points, as well as including an access point with each one of these carts that we're talking about from the network. So it kind of helps reinforce what we already have in the buildings. When we initially put the wireless in, it really wasn't with the intention of having 30 students all logging on at the same time and hitting that same access point. It's a little overwhelming for it. So we're going to need to do a little bit more with regards to upgrading that. The lab computers will remain for a year. We'll get through one more year with that equipment, and then next year we will do a bit of a refresh, kind of a limited refresh. We're also going to look at piloting Google Docs and Microsoft Live accounts. Right now, it's free. and it will give online storage for our students. There's potential for email for our students. And as you look at these PAD technologies, they're not really going to tie in with our network to be able to access things like email or storage. So pretty much the benefit there is, how do you get online and how are you able to collaborate and share and also save and store your files, which is kind of lower our footprint for servers as well. And we're also looking at replacing our current student information system. The one we have now just isn't meeting our needs. It has not been able to move forward with us at the same speed that we're moving. And it's just not able to maintain and handle our needs, as well as being able to combine a lot of the data sources that we have. It's just not able to do that. So we're now in the process of researching some other possibilities for that.
Does the Google Docs include calendar and
Google Docs? I'm pretty sure it does. I know the Microsoft Live product does. It incorporates pretty much all of your Office suite in there. And that will include your calendar. That's something that we're just starting to look at now. And we want to do kind of a limited pilot, maybe a few classrooms that have them next year, and see how that fits, particularly with collaboration with access to their information. So rather than having to access our network here to get to the documents, they can go to the website anywhere they want and be able to access the documents.
They have Google Apps too, though, like, you know, an Excel or a PowerPoint.
Right. They're comparable, and we need to see what the interoperability of that is with our versions of Office, and to see how well that's going to work. I'm assuming the Microsoft Live product is going to have full integration with the Office products. Google Docs will have to do a little bit more research to see.
Can we let
Yeah.
Go back to our agreement that we had before, that let the presentation.
Okay. So, well, the outcomes that we'll see from this first phase would, first of all, be a greater equity and access to technology. We'll have a true potential for a one-to-one in the classroom. We plan on taking these netbooks and carts of 20 and then strategically locating them throughout the building. So they're available. Like on the second and third floors, where we've got a couple of workrooms, we could use that as a charging station. And we can house as many as 60 or 80 on those one floor, which could easily be shared amongst the classrooms. And same thing on the fourth, where we have them available for the classrooms out there. I know LA uses laptops every day for their students, and some even in a one-to-one kind of ratio. And now we would have a fleet that would be able to do that. It gives us more reliable and flexible technology. It's new world. We're not going to be dealing with breakdowns. The equipment we have right now is out of warranty, so we're out of pocket quite a bit of hardware just to keep them up and running. Also gives us a variety of technology, almost sort of a tiered structure of technology. So with tablets, you can be able to pilot those and see how those work on a kind of a thin client sort of basis. The netbooks will give us ease of access to simple computing tasks. We'll also keep a fleet of existing laptops in the buildings. We've got about 270 at the junior high right now. We'll cut that in half, leave half of those at the junior high available for takeout in the LLCs, just like they are now. And we'll take the other half and we'll roll them out into the grade school so that they get a benefit of additional laptops. Right now, they've got about 30 in each building. So we can raise that fleet and also get them comfortable using that kind of technology, which we will be rolling out within the next phase of our plan. Of course, this gives our students immediate access to information and promotes 21st century learning. And will hopefully free up our labs. Right now, our labs are just booked constantly. Even for some of the more low-level kind of tasks that we would have a computer to do, like research on the web or just using a creative Word document. Those kind of tasks can be filled off a smaller netbook like this and free up the labs for more creative projects, and something that would require a little bit more horsepower of the PC to be able to run, as well as critical thinking, collaboration, communication. All of these goals should be achieved with a different type of model at the junior high for technology. And of course, greater operational efficiencies once we do land on a student information system that will fit our needs. It will take a lot of the kind of troubleshooting that we're doing to keep the current system functioning and working to fit our needs. Second phase for the 12-13 school year would be the grade schools. So I'm going to start looking at refreshing the grade school technology. It's been about, at that point, it will have been about 5 years since we've done anything there. It'll be kind of a similar model, but there will be differences between the grade school and the junior high because they use the technology in a different way. And they have different tools for it. We'll refresh the desktops just like the grade school. It'll be the same kind of concept. It's hooked to their AV equipment, their smartphone, their projector, the printer in the classroom. We'll take the existing desktops that are in the grade schools. They're slightly newer. They're more capable than we have right now in our labs, and we'll repurpose them in the labs for a year. It's kind of a stopgap as we kind of evaluate our labs, how we're using them, how we want to use them in the future. Probably a minor memory upgrade will keep them up and running and be viable for another year as we kind of look at what our refresh cycle should look like for our labs. Again, we'll reinforce the wireless coverage. We'll more than likely look at a laptop solution for the grade schools as well. The netbooks might work as a fourth and fifth grade solution, but at the primary levels, where you still deal with a lot of real heavy graphic intensive kind of programs, they require a little bit more horsepower. So you might be looking at more of a full-blown laptop for those kind of students. But when we begin the next school year, we'll do the same thing we did as we did with Hadley. We'll get together grade level teams, and we'll form a focus group, and we'll ask them, you know, what do they think would best suit their needs? What do they see as being their classroom in the future? We'll continue our smart board rollout. I'd like to get substantial completion of our smart board rollout by next year. I'd like to see that kind of done within a couple of years. I think when we've seen some of our rollouts go on 4 or 5 years, it's too long a cycle. You can't really put those on any kind of a refresh cycle because you've got such a scattering of technology out there. Not to mention different models that are harder to support, now you need different components for them. And the technology's already become antiquated by the time you finish your rollout. After a couple of years, I don't know that we put a smart board in every room, but I think we'd have a substantial enough coverage to where we would fit our needs for the smart board. We'll continue to pilot the tablet technology. That could very well be the phase of the future. That could be what we use for our student one-to-one ratio down the road. We'll also be looking at our data warehouse integration. We currently have a data warehouse that administrators and even teachers have access to. It has all of our assessment scores in it. We want to integrate that in with our new student information system, as well as how our grade book interacts with that and how that works. Right now we have a lot of data pulls and pushes that go back and forth that feed off of our student information system. It's very cumbersome to deal with. So we're looking at creating some efficiencies in there for us. We want to continue to expand the online storage for students at Hadley. If the pilot goes really well this year, we may roll it out to all the students at Hadley. We still have some things that we want to figure out, and we're not quite sure that's a good fit for us. We may just expand that pilot. And as I said before, we continue to consolidate our operational system. So we have basically a single platform that we can work off of. So the outcomes for this phase are very similar to the outcomes from the first phase. You know, we have greater access and equity for technology for our students. There's a potential for a one-to-one in the classroom with the rolling parts, a variety of technologies for teachers to choose from and differentiate, which is going to be the best fit for whatever the lesson plan is, and again, a greater capacity for wireless, and to continue to promote our 21st century learning. We'll also look at a full evaluation of our computer labs, as I said before, and see what's the best fit for that going forward. And again, continue to merge our data systems to a single platform. So in the next couple board meetings, I'll start bringing some of these recommendations in. The Hadley refresh would be soon, finalizing some of the quotes from the vendors, see what we're going to get for pricing. These numbers are just kind of what we have for retail costs. These wouldn't actually be the cost we would get, but it gives you an idea of what our investment's going to be, and that also could be a grade school refresh as well. Given the numbers of equipment that we would see in meeting, and then the cost will work with the vendors to bring those in. Usually on this equipment, we work on a three-year cycle, on a lease cycle for our laptops or our smaller equipment, because generally they're not going to last 4 or 5 years. And the desktops, we will work on a 5-year cycle, because those will last for that period of time. But this way, at least keeps us current and keeps the equipment viable and usable. So it's not hanging around for 10 years. So with all this additional technology and all this new technology, professional development will be critical for our staff to be able to utilize it. We have and will continue to have targeted after-school trainings depending on what the new technologies are. We try to focus on what teachers' needs are for after-school trainings. The last couple of years, we've had institute days that center around technology. They've been very well received, and it's been an exciting time. I know they're working because a couple of weeks after those institute days are helped us put law goes through the roof, so people are actually using some of these things. Our training is framed around the National Education Standards for Technology, the NET standards. Of course, we're any kind of training that's done keeps in mind district learner to support district learner characteristics. The Partners in Tech program we've had for years, it used to be grant-funded. Grant funding has gone away, but we're going to continue to fund this program on our own because it is a nice benefit and kind of a mentoring program for teachers to be able to share and collaborate with their own technology ideas. We've got a smart board user group. We've got a pilot of about a dozen boards out there now. The teachers that are piloting those boards are part of this user group. They meet once a month, and they'll provide as a resource for us in the buildings to be able to help teachers that are getting new boards in and support them with their ideas and just kind of, you know, basically just a support structure to help them show them how to use it and help them out. We have weekly tech trainings here at CSO on Thursday morning between 8 and 9. We have some kind of tech training. So,
can we come?
Whatever. Please stop by. So every Thursday morning, we have the tech trainings here.
When's Ann's Twitter class?
Pardon me?
When does Ann teach Twitter class? We've
got to cover that.
We have a Twitter class. It's April.
Was it April 21st?
I can't possibly remember the date.
We just did the calendar today.
And of course, a focus on 21st century skills, critical thinking, communication, collaboration, information and media literacy skills, and textual learning skills. The next phase, we'd be looking at our lab evaluation completed. I would see our labs in the buildings as being more of a creative kind of environment, not as much doing papers or working on a spreadsheet, but maybe utilizing some other types of technology that's a more creative nature. We should have enough technology out in the classrooms to handle some of the basic kind of computing needs. I think the labs could be opened up for more high-powered kind of computing, whether it's using CAD programs or web development or any of a number of other much broader kinds of things that we can do in the labs. But with the lab refresh, it's also we also looked at what's the impact on our libraries. I mean, most of our labs exist in our libraries. Mm-hmm. Once a month, I meet with all the tech aides in the district and the LLC directors. And so the question that I posed to them at our last meeting was, well, what do you see as your labs or your libraries looking like in the next four to five years? I mean, what changes do you see, and how do you see that integrating in with technology? Things like e-books came up and having a kind of a center for collaboration and you know, online books, multimedia creation, collaboration, a hub for technology. The LLC shouldn't just be about books, but also about collaboration and technology and how that ties in. I mean, if we could picture a library without books, and maybe it's just everything's on a tablet and your books are on a tablet, even the textbooks are on a tablet. Look at all the space you have in that library. What else can we do with that? So that's something that we started talking about, and we'll start developing a committee to work on those ideas as well. Again, we want to expand on our online storage and our email. One of the big goals that I have is we currently have about 32 servers in our district, and that's a lot for a district this size, and it's a lot for a tech department. It's only three guys that do all the heavy work. Mm-hmm. So we need to kind of start streamlining that down, consolidating our servers. Every solution we're looking at now, we're looking at how efficiently can we build that in, and also what can we do that's online? What can we do? What can we take advantage of as far as hosted services? Things like Google Docs or Microsoft Line to kind of take some of that stress off of our network and put it on somebody else's, particularly when it's free. So it sort of lowers our costs and lowers our workload here. And that kind of comes into leveraging cloud computing. I'm sure everyone's heard that term now, and that is kind of where we're going. Everything's going to be web-based. And everything that is web-based also creates less strain on the local machine. I can run pretty much anything I want just web-based on. So any kind of application, any kind of storage, as long as it's web-based, I can use pretty much any device to get to it and use it, which lowers our cost for equipment download as well. We're not spending as much as we are for a local workstation to run the applications that we want. So with that, we're going to look at a full software review and look at all the software that we currently have, and you know what can we replace it with that is going to leverage cloud computing, web-based computing, as well as doing a complete server and backup evaluation. Also, this should be able to take some of the backup demands that we have away. So we're not looking at as many servers for backups or the very costly solutions for backing up our data on a daily basis. So our outcomes from that would be, of course, a revitalized app, new equipment, new software, and a new approach to how we use our labs. Again, move to more web-based computing. I want to reduce our printer fee. With as much technology as we continue to move to a digital kind of format, we shouldn't need to print as much. So we're going to be looking at a printer refresh coming up soon, and if we can start moving to a more digital kind of format, we won't need as many printers, we won't need to print as much, we won't need to spend as much on toner, and we won't need to spend as much on printing in general. But a lot of things that get printed didn't really need to be printed. It's in a PDF form, it's there to be read. I'm more concerned about saving on the cost from printing that out. And again, like I said, beginning to scale back the quantity of our district servers and begin to reimagine what our libraries are going to look like and how they're going to utilize technology there. Once you get past that phase, we're starting to look at refreshing Hadley again. The cycle kind of begins again. And 3 years from now, technology could look very different. You know, we see our students using it on a daily basis may not be what we think it's going to be. Maybe it will be tablet technology. Maybe it will have evolved to that point, and we move our structure to the point where we can fully utilize a device like that at hopefully a much lower price point and be able to raise our volume. So, of course, that would mean analysis of student devices, what's going to be the best fit, and what's going to fit in best with our network here. And I'd like to see us go to a full one-to-one of some device for our students that have it by now. That we should be able to get to a device that's cost-efficient enough, that's powerful enough, and is efficient enough to use technology that we have in place to get some device in every student's hand. And begin the refresh of our LLCs and see what that's going to look like. And see how we're going to leverage technology in our libraries. And, of course, we'll always continue to research emerging technologies. What's going to be coming up every 2 or 3 years? Because every 2 or 3 years is kind of looking like the cycle right now, as quickly as things are changing. And, of course, again, eliminate the need to house a lot of files and folders locally on our servers here. How much can we push off to some remote service that frees up our time and our tech guys' time to get out into the buildings, do maybe a little bit more creative troubleshooting rather than just blowing a printer jam, and I need somebody to clear it. And of course, access to critical data from anywhere. So the more we can leverage cloud computing, web-based computing, the easier technology is to get at, the easier your information is to get at from wherever you are, without having to punch holes in our own network and possibly compromise the security of our network. Questions?
Wow. I know. First of all, I forgot how long that you've been with us. And you said how, I mean, that sort of, like, oh, wow, Mike, you really have been here. So you've really seen all that. It has gone fast. One of the things that you talked about in terms of, first of all, we use Google Docs at my house. So it was interesting to hear you say that because I know my daughter's often had to access her Google Doc at school because she got to print it out. So, or put it on her flash drive, because I think sometimes those flash drives, they conk out, they get damaged, and so they don't work. So the ability to access them on some internet-based thing, application.
That I haven't thought of
the
student.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's infinite. I mean, even with the blogging and the way that the kids could do it. So that was, you know, the to me, that you're thinking about how to develop, use our technology to access the free stuff that's out there, that was really a good thing. And the tablets.
It's not free forever, guys. I don't want to set an expectation.
No, but I mean,
for right now.
But for right now, it's something that we can access, that kids can access, that, you know, that we should utilize. And you're right. I'm sure that there will be a licensing fee or whatever that we'll have to use at some point, but it's also a mechanism that parents can go online with their kids at home and look at some of these things and be able to help monitor and take a look at those things that they're doing. So, to me, it's a partnership. But the tablets, I don't know that much about them, so it'll be interesting to see it. You know, you talking about them, but you see them everywhere on TV, and that you're thinking about how are we going to use them.
The tablets are just kind of big phones right now. They use the same operating system that a phone uses, and they have a lot of the same applications and the same services that a phone provides, with the absence of being able to make a phone call. So just kind of it's an evolving technology right now. As we watch and see how it does evolve, and the things that I'm looking for in a tablet, once those start to become available, I think those could be very viable devices for us down the road.
Well, and the other thing that I wondered about, Ian, and Erica, maybe, I mean, for those of you with high schoolers, do the high schoolers take their laptops to school?
Very rarely.
No?
Okay.
It's not a rare.
They go to lab. They use a lot of the lab time. They have a math lab, you know, so they use it. They have a new language lab, so the students go in and use technology in that way in the language lab. But no, they don't.
At least freshmen.
No, seniors, too. She doesn't.
Would they let them set it up and take notes in their laptops?
I don't know. That's not come up in conversation. I will tell you that when I was at the Church of PTA meeting, this very issue came up in terms of a couple of fifth graders wanting to bring their e-readers in during quiet reading time. And so that was shared. And Scott also talked about the pilot, you know, with that. So, you know, I will tell you that first of all, I think we're really fortunate as a district to have Mike, who's a great technologist, but also able to capture and communicate the plan really succinctly, so that the community understands this. And then I think the third leg of the stool, Mike, is that you have the vision to get out there and be asking those questions. What do you envision the library to look like, et cetera? And made me think about, as a part of the referendum that didn't pass, some of the plan for Hadley was to have that media center. And I'm thinking back to the picture of that, which included exactly what you're visioning, which is how are we adapting our LLCs? And that was really where we saw some of the referendum dollars being utilized, because we saw it that many, you know, whatever, how many years ago? I don't remember. Anyway. That was a part of the conversation. So, I'll add to that comment about the high school. I happen to be with a client at the medical school up north, the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science, and I sat in on an org meeting that they had where they talked specifically about technology. And what their technology director said was that junior highs, elementary, junior high, and high schools are driving the technology at the undergraduate and graduate level. We are nowhere near where we need to be ready for the students coming in with the level of technology experience they'll have now coming out of school. So that, you know, we're driving some of that decision making in their strategic plan. And it's very evident to them that they're behind the curve.
Well, and the reason that I asked about, you know, the ability to bring your own, I mean, we always talk about preparing them for the next thing. So fifth grade, you're preparing for Hadley. Hadley, you're preparing for high school. High school is preparing for college, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I just was curious, you know, is this an opportunity?
I think that's a great question to ask the tech director. Glengard, you probably
right, but as you talked about, you know, you asked the LLC directors what do you envision this to look like and what do the spaces look like? Is that a space where the kids can plug something in? Because I mean, I know when I was in law school, in the new buildings that were built, every, you know, row of table had an outlet. And I believe in many of the universities now, you know, that's what the schools are looking to. And, you know, to heck with penmanship now lately. The kids just sit and type so the teachers can read it. And it's that instantaneous way of doing it. And in fact, kids don't see many classes. They don't even handwrite rough drafts. They go right to their computers and they're typing these things out. So as part of that, you know, looking forward, how do we develop these classrooms to be wireless and to give these spaces? And you were talking about that. So I appreciate that you are thinking that way, and that's why I was asking that question.
Yeah, as far as students bringing in devices, I mean, it kind of depends on the device. If it's a phone or something like that, that's probably not going to potentially compromise your security. And also for support. I mean, if a student brought in a laptop and, well, they had a problem with the laptop, well, you know, what do you do to help them? Where if we provide the technology for them, we're pretty sure it's going to work. And we're going to have support for it and tech people that are able to support it because they
can do it. Secure. Right.
And it's secure. You know, certain things like cell phones, you don't really need to worry about security as much, even though those are starting to get compromised now. But it's one of the things that, from my perspective, I'm always looking at, well, is there going to be a compromise and is it an acceptable risk for us to take?
And I hadn't thought about the security, but you're right. So perhaps the Google, you know, the internet-based applications to be able to access these things might be a more secure way for kids to be able to access these things. But
can you go to your 3 to 5 year refresh cycle? I'm just wondering. It seems like we're doing a lot of refreshing over the next 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and then we're going to start looking at, you know, hosting and cloud computing and all that
in
12 or, you know, 13, I guess. So I'm sure you put a lot of thought to this, but is there, you know, I just would hate to see us go through that, all that refresh, and then take sort of a different architectural approach to how we might plug kids in or out, or, you know, switches or not switches. Would that mean?
Yeah, I mean, the switching equipment's already in place, so that's not going to go away anytime soon, because we're still going to need some connectivity back to our backbone. But when you start to get out past 12 and 13, I mean, that's all still very much up for debate. I mean, some of this equipment we may not need anymore. I've got things in here like domain controllers and storage servers and things like that that I'm hoping we can kind of do away with when we start getting out there. As things look like now, I have to anticipate to refresh that. So, you know, we do look at this on a regular basis. And it's basically, as things look today, if nothing changed, this is kind of how we would look at our refresh cycle.
So I think what I'm asking is, you know, would you see value, or is there something not allowing you to maybe think about that now before we refresh to, you know, look at your architecture and maybe save money or put money, you know, in hosting so that you can do other things? Is that?
Yeah, it is something we're looking at right now. I think for the devices that we're going to need for right now, I think that what we're talking about is a good fit. But that's not a fit that's going to last for very long. I mean, the netbooks and the laptops that we have, we're only looking at a 3-year cycle. Before those, you know, the batteries don't last much longer than 3 years. And generally, they almost become disposable to a certain degree.
Right.
So after that 3-year period on our lease cycle, we would probably give that equipment back to the leasing company. In which case, the arrangement we have with them, they put those up for sale, and we would get a little piece of the
like we did the last time. The last time you brought that to the table, yeah.
Okay. And then, is there a strategy around Mac versus not Mac, or in terms of where
we are getting some iPads? And the issue I have with putting too many Macs on our network right now is, first of all, we have a Windows network.
Okay.
So in order to fully integrate in Macs, would require another server. It would require a server to make that bridge. Plus, Mac technology tends to be more expensive than PC technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a Mac Pro book, I can get I can still get a laptop, a PC laptop, for considerably less money that's going to be more powerful than that Mac Pro. And all the software we currently have, a majority of the software we currently have, runs on PC.
So our direction is to remain on Windows PC and...
For the majority, I think we're going to start looking at the potential for maybe a lab at the junior high that might be Mac-based. We already have a few Macs in the Applied Tech Lab.
Right, Mr.
And see how that works in. So we weren't ready to just jump in feet first, because that would be... And his lab would be up for refresh as well. This is part of the... This is one of the labs that I was talking about when I talked about the lab. So that's one of those things that we're going to start to investigate and see what's going to be maybe a better fit, and certainly the best fit for us going forward. So I'm not ruling it out, but I'm just saying that for right now, the way our network is built, it's not really built to accommodate a lot of Mac technology.
Okay. And then on your slide 6, you mentioned that the classroom desktop manages the smart board, the printers, and things like that. And then if I just look at the cost associated, it looks like, with a desktop versus a laptop. Do we really feel we need desktops anymore? Like, could those be laptops, and then they kind of provide that they're cheaper, plus they're portable, so...
Well, we did look at that, and the laptop might initially look to be cheaper, but when you're talking about a device that's going to run your smart board, your projector, and possibly your printer, that's a lot of inputs to have to connect. And as teachers are traveling with these, which they no doubt will, if they have laptops in most places, they'd have to come in and pretty much hook up all of this stuff to get those things to work. And they're probably not going to do that. So what we'd have to do is we'd have to also provide a docking station for each one of those laptops, which would have all these things already connected. And then if they wanted a keyboard or a monitor, well, pretty soon that cost level goes way up. So even just putting the docking station is going to elevate that cost to where it's going to be at least as much, if not more, than a desktop. And then you're looking at a piece of equipment that now needs to be refreshed every 3 years, potentially, as opposed to having a desktop that's in place that will be there for at least 5 years. So your long-term costs are going to be less for the desktop, and I think even your short-term costs will more than likely be less for the desktop.
I hadn't thought about the transfer, moving around classrooms, that's all that.
Right.
Didn't even think about that.
Right, and then the liability of a laptop, just in general, the chances of it dropped, lost, stolen. The desktop is pretty much going to stay where it is.
So you want to continue using a desktop?
At least for this next cycle. You know, when we reevaluate it, we may have a different device that we think is going to be better suited.
Right. Can you go to
Well, we don't usually do that, but members of the audience. But since you're here and you withstood all this, go ahead.
How would you prioritize these? Which would be your top three, your middle three, and then your bottom three in terms of the importance to advancing the technology of the district?
Well, my priority is to give more technology in the hands of our students, and less invested on back-end technology that I'm seeing is kind of bloated right now. So my first priority is to get technology out into the classrooms more so.
Okay. Give me three examples of how you think that could be accomplished in 2011 and 2012.
Well, 2011 and this coming year, you know, first of all, we're elevating the fleet of equipment out in the junior high pretty significantly. So I think that's at least going to give a better opportunity for students to get that one-to-one ratio. Moving forward, I think the more we're able to shrink our footprint for back-end technology, that will free up dollars to be able to get more technology out in the classroom.
Look, I understand that, but what I'm looking for is three specific examples of what you would do in phase one to accomplish the two goals that you just described.
Well, looking at the network technology.
Okay.
Gets us some additional workstations out there to lower cost. So that would be one.
Would that be your highest priority?
I think that's going to be probably the biggest thing that we'll see, the biggest change that we'll see.
You think that would have the greatest impact in the classroom on the students' ability to learn and the teacher's ability to teach?
I think it would be certainly something that the teachers have been asking for, and I think that it would be a bigger impact on students being able to have that instant access to information and that one-on-one type of.
How about number two and number three? What would be your second and third recommendation?
For this coming year, well, the smart boards probably be second. As far as getting technology into the hands, that more interactive kind of approach to the classroom, so students do get that. And I do think the piloting of the tablet technology is a big one. Even though it is not a big quantity, I definitely see that as being something that's going to be an emerging technology that can very well, you know, take over some of the things like laptops. It's certainly going to get rid of things like e-books or Kindles or e-readers because it's going to incorporate that technology already, plus give you a lot more. It's just not quite done yet. So as that technology starts to emerge, I think that's going to be really something that we can really leverage here. And if the price point's being down, it helps us get to the quantity as well.
One final follow-up. Of these particular technologies, either in 2011, 2012, or 13 and 14, which would be the three that you think could be deferred without compromising either the student's ability to learn or the teacher's ability to teach?
You know what, I guess I'm not sure, Mike, if you're going to,
I think we'll make this our last question.
Sorry,
we don't typically allow members of the audience to participate in board meetings. Yeah. So.
So you're asking what do I see as something you wouldn't need?
That you could defer to a later date.
Well, one of the things that we're deferring to already are the labs. I mean, that's something we're deferring for 2 years. And that's equipment that really should probably be refreshed right now. But given I really want to get more technology into the classroom rather than in the lab, we're already kind of deferring that. Outside of that, printers, I always think, for printers.
You don't want to use those anyway.
Right. But having not given that portion a whole lot of thought, I don't think I can come up with a third one.
It's okay. Those are all very good. Thanks very much. And I appreciate the indulgence of the board.
Can we go to page phase one outcomes? How about potential for one-to-one?
Speak up.
Sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
Go ahead.
Oh, I had a list of questions. On the one-to-one there, what did you mean by that versus the one-to-one student? Is that just one?
I'm saying there's a potential for a one-to-one in the classroom.
But so is that kid to computer or is that classroom to
device?
No, that's kid to device. Kid to laptop, kid to netbook, kid to PC. We have that potential now. We get the fleet up to a quantity where the teacher wanted to bring in 20 or 25 laptops so each student could have one. We could do that.
Okay. So that's implementing the phase one components. We could get to a one-to-one. It's not...
And we could do that now, really.
Right.
We just don't have enough to really go around to where everybody feels like they have equal access to the technology.
Okay. And just as a point of clarification, John, it might not mean one-to-one for every student every day.
Right, and that's where I think, that's what I was trying to differentiate between
phase three
and beyond, which was full one-to-one for Hadley.
Right.
So that's why I was just trying to make sure what the definition was.
Yeah, and at that point, we may have, there's already textbooks that are available online.
Right.
But as textbooks become available as a digital document, the student would have this device as their textbook, their access to the internet, their word processing, their Excel spreadsheet, pretty much everything.
Okay. Now, if you go to phase two, what does a memory upgrade mean these days? What do you...
On the desktops, it's just the RAM. So right now, those have, I think, a gig of RAM that they came with.
Okay.
In order to run Windows Office, because every time there's a new iteration of any of these applications, they're more resource intensive.
Right. So you're going to 2 gig or?
Right. We'll probably bump it up to an extra gig, and this way it'll give us enough horsepower to get through.
I didn't even know we were at 1 gig. So.
Yeah. Well,
I saw 5 to 10 years, and I'm like, oh my god.
Those machines are those would be 4 years old.
Right.
So the ones at Hadley, those are 5 and older.
Okay. And then on the expand student online storage, where do the teacher websites reside on our servers and network?
Yes,
today?
Mm-hmm. the teacher websites do reside on our service or on our web server.
Give any sense of how big that is? I mean, it's not one server's worth, but is it?
It's actually, it's not that huge. It's just talking about the size, the capacity of it.
Yeah, I'm just going back to the, you know, is there a hosting opportunity here sooner, because of saving money?
And there could be. And one of the, when we did upgrade our web servers, we did so with it, keeping that in mind that we had enough capacity to handle things like our teacher website. So, but as far as that goes, we're well within any limits. We're not hitting a wall or anything for storage or for performance.
Just a few more on your technology investment, your dollar side. Is this, when you talk smart boards and netbooks and cards and all that, is this something that we go out to one vendor for, or how does that process work?
Well, the smart boards, we're currently getting on a consortium deal, so the cost for the boards is going to be what it is. It's probably not going to get any cheaper than that. Mm-hmm. And there's only a limited amount of vendors that are participating in that. So right now, we've used a couple of vendors already for installation, and I've gone to both of them to get quotes on a full installation. So the real difference here is going to be in installation costs and maybe mounting materials, but I'm guessing the mounting materials they use are the same. It's just going to really come down to cost between those two vendors.
Okay, so you go to multiple vendors for for this stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then for the desktops and the netbooks, we've got HP and Dell that will be competing.
Okay. And do you do we buy our netbooks or desktops with other districts and try to pool and get a bigger savings, or is it all bought on our own?
It's all bought on our own, and at this point, I don't know of any other districts. I'm sure there are other districts that are doing that. When we go through our vendors to get this equipment, it's all on an Illinois state contract, so it's all kind of set pricing. And you're almost kind of picking the vendor more than you're picking the hardware, because the price is already kind of set with HP or Dell through a cost that they get for the state.
So like HP has a standard contract with the state of Illinois
for education only, or for all government?
Well, they've got several tiers, but education is one. Yeah. And then they do have a government tier as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then phase three. Full software review. I didn't really see any software review before 2013, and I just remember in some labs, you know, we talked about, you know, either Adobe or some other programs to help do some other things. Does that fall out of the scope of a full software review? Or?
Well, there are some softwares that we've implemented in the lab. Like WebBlender or WebExpression.
Right.
There's some new softwares that we've introduced for things like web development. What I'm talking about here is sort of looking at a lot of the locally installed programs, the software that we actually have to install on the workstation, and seeing where we can start building some efficiencies and moving more towards web or browser-based technologies for those applications, rather than having as many locally installed programs that tend to cause us to have to get more powerful
hardware
for
growing
now.
All
right,
thanks.
Thank you.
Dan.
Thank you. That technology investment slide, is the total cost on there, does that cover all three phases?
Only the first two. And those would be for the major purchases. And like I say, I'm still getting costs from our vendors. So those aren't really final dollars. It's just a little ballpark estimate, just to give you an idea of it. And like you said, those will be on leasing schedules that will run either 3 or 5 years. The smart boards, we may look at even a longer leasing schedule to kind of ease the payments over that period of time, because I would see those boards as being in our classrooms for a minimum of 5 years, not longer.
And what would be the yearly delta for those two phases?
I can get those costs. I haven't really gone to our leasing agent yet to get what our...
I mean, to our IT budget, thankfully. The overall IT budget. I mean, you have an IT budget,
right?
And if you did these, what would be that delta for those 2 years? Or
can I? I was explaining to the Finance Committee earlier this evening, we'll be bringing a very preliminary budget in the first week or two of April, and Mike's plan would be rolled out into that budget, or into that budget, and then we would provide individualized sort of departmental budgets within that, the larger scope of things. So I think right now, I know what Mike's technology plan is. After he completes that, we'll need to sit down with the various leasing agencies that we have arrangements with, and then we discuss the final final terms and so forth. But right now, to try to sort of say dollar-wise, this is going to be $400,000 a year or $200,000 a year, I think we're a little bit,
I had built those numbers into my budget, but honestly, I couldn't remember them off the top of my head to really give you a dollar amount as a differential between our budget from last year and next year, where we'd be the year after. So, but as we do start getting our quotes in from the vendors and then the leasing company, we'll have a more concrete idea of what that's going
to be. Would it be fair to say that it's an increase over
previous budget? And I just to put some context to that, in the years when we were doing some heavy curriculum development, and depending on where our long-range plan priorities are for a given year or for a period of years, then we examine our budget development against those priorities first. And technology has been identified as one of those priority areas for the renewal of the plan.
Mike would have three accounts with which to work these different investments in. Some might be through purchase services, capital outlay, and then we have a leasing that we go through our debt service fund. That could also be part of this whole process. So there'll be several ways of looking at how to finance these projects over the next 3 to 5 years.
I think you pretty much explained my next question, which was,
how do we decide?
Or where, you know, there's like a big, I guess I'll call it a chunk of money that, you know, we have a big curriculum or a new textbook or something. Mm-hmm. And so
who gets the priority here?
Right.
Yeah.
Who gets the biggest cut?
Okay. Any other questions?
Homework. You're way ahead of us.
Yeah.
Nice job.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. All right. Thanks, Ryan. Move on to action items. Are there any items board members would like removed from the consent agenda to be considered separately? Hearing none, may have a motion to approve the consent agenda as presented, which includes the following items. A, the consent agenda, including human resources, personnel report, employment recommendations, resignations, resignations and retirements, the finance and facilities and operations report, and other matters, including the board meeting minutes from February 21st, 2011 public hearing and regular meeting, as well as the case board meeting action items.
Motion.
Second. Roll call, please.
Ms. Nelson?
Yes.
Ms. Howard?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Solar?
Yes. Action items B, the superintendent's recommendations. Item 1, the 2011 and 2012 proposed school calendar. At its February 21st, 2011 meeting, the board discussed a draft of the proposed school calendar for 2011-2012. I would like to note that there has been a correction made to the calendar, changing the November 3rd parent-teacher conference day from a non-attendance day to a noon dismissal for students. The administration is recommending that the board approve the proposed calendar as presented. May I have a motion to approve the 2011-2012 proposed school calendar?
Motion.
Second.
Second.
Discussion.
I have one question. On the Thanksgiving weekend,
mm-hmm.
am I interpreting this correctly that we're only in school Monday and Tuesday?
Yes, that's correct. And a half SIP day, which was kind of accumulated during the conference period, teachers will be in session in the morning of that Wednesday.
So
the students will not.
It's a half SIP day.
Yes, for teachers.
For teachers.
But
the students
will not attend at all.
Right.
The SIP day will be in the morning.
Is that different than last year? I thought we did school on the 23rd last year.
We didn't last year. We did the same.
Is there anything that indicated that we lost a lot of kids that week?
Our attendance is affected that week. But we have periods throughout the year where attendance might be impacted based on.
I just curious about the data. Mm-hmm. I know that for a while. We had that whole week off.
Yeah, we were asking.
The third or fourth year where we've been in school all that week.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be the third year that
I think it's the third year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the high school is still in school that week.
Yeah, that's what
mm-hmm.
it is. Yeah. Okay.
And just so after it went to the board, we had the calendar committee who did not formally meet, but we informally discussed that we will be meeting before the end of the school year to kind of talk about some ideas for the next calendar already and some creation of some more commonalities and issues that, you know, all of us have seen.
Talking about the bigger topics.
That's right, talking mm-hmm. about the bigger topics of, you know.
Full day, sit days?
That's a bargaining item.
Before I leave the board, I would like to once again reiterate my desire for full day sit days.
Thank you,
Sharon.
Thank you for sharing, Bob.
Second. I already raised my concerns last time, and I know last year I reluctantly accepted the calendar with the expectation that it would get better. And I guess in my mind, I don't see a lot of improvement in terms of some of these days where there's no school and then having a no student attendance day right after. I still don't understand why we can't have, you know, the teachers hold their institute days on, you know, some of these holidays. Then the whole President's Day thing, I still don't understand why we don't have the sick day or the institute day on the federal holiday.
Dan, many people share that same question. And in fairness to our bargaining units, that is a bargaining item.
Well,
I will tell you, we did not even have that discussion this year about holding an institute day on one of the Columbus Fair President. Didn't even come up. And, you know, it's funny because after we presented this, while I would have people say, oh my gosh, I love how you paired these together again. I think this calendar is better than last year's, even though it's essentially the same calendar. The issue of half day and full day sits, that is an issue that we as a group, as a board, we have to address it the next time around. It's not something that, you know, if it came up, it was immediately, that's a bargaining, that's not an issue for the calendar committee to address. That's an issue that, you know, our bargaining units, and I understand what you're saying. Truthfully, this calendar is last year's calendar, with the exception of Christmas, and with the midweek Christmas. It's pretty much the same calendar. And
Karen, I didn't think it was a bargaining issue if we had sick day on a Columbus Day.
It is not a bargaining issue for our teachers. We do have other employee groups for whom those days are considered a part of their contract as paid holidays. So we would be having to go back in with other groups within the system to look at those days differently. And
I thought there was some, if you don't have the students there at all,
and if we use
disparity between like working days and total attendance.
Right. We would be, our calendar would be much earlier. We would, if we used all of our holidays as teacher days but non-student days, we would remove 5 days from the calendar, so we would end 5 days earlier. So you would end before Labor Day. I mean, Labor Day.
Right.
That's really short. You would end before Memorial Day. So between that item and other labor groups that we would have to negotiate with individually, we didn't bring that back. Now, we did talk about Columbus Day, and as I think I've said to everybody, I committed to the other districts that the day after Columbus Day would be a common institute day for all of us. So we can revisit Columbus Day next year, and I've notified the superintendents of the Glenbard Associate District that may, you know, not be a day any longer. But if we seek to find common institute days, which has been a goal of the associate districts, and the board at the time agreed that was one of the priorities, to find some common institute days, I can probably guarantee that the other districts are not ready to not have, you know, use holidays for that purpose.
And in fairness, I mean, you know, seeing one of the comments that you made was, you know, hey, you were off on President's Day and your kids all had to go to school, and, you know, should we be doing that? And you know, and I thought about that because I stand by, we did not develop a calendar so people could go on vacation. We developed a calendar for learning. And I think it's important when we look at, there's really only 3 institute days during the school year. 3 institute days over the course of the entire school year in terms of the fact that our students are in school is not a lot. So I really don't think the issue is the number of institute days and when they're held. I really believe the issue that the board and many members of our community feel, it's the AHAS-SIP day. And that is something that we will deal with when we go into our next contract negotiation. That is an issue that we want to discuss. So I respect what you're saying about having the institute day on the Columbus Day or President's Day or whatever that is. But if you didn't, you probably wouldn't look at it the same. It's the half days every month that seems really, that's where when you look at the days, that's where you have the strongest sense of chopping up your month versus the 2 days being put together, giving you a 4-day weekend, and then the kids go to school for 6 days. I mean, I think that really seems to be more the issue. There's only 3.
Can I just clarify, though? I think there are 10, but there are only 3.
There's 3 during the calendar year.
There's 8 institute days.
Right.
Okay.
But
I just want to make sure that's clear, that there are 8.
There are 8.
There are only 3 during these. There's some before and one after.
Which is one of the things that over the past couple of years that we have worked on changing, that the institute days are at the beginning of the year before the students arrive, and at the end of the year when the students are no longer with us. So during the time that the students are in our building, there are only 3. And I, you know, and one of them is a countywide institute day where, you know, we're also dealing with the county, and now hopefully, you know, we're going to be working with our feeder district. So we create a culture of learning, we support a culture of learning, and we need to do respect and support that for our staff as well. So again, I don't think the issue that we really have is with the number of institute days. The questions with developing the calendar surround our SIP days, and while we have seen an increase, or, you know, not increase, I think we've definitely seen an improvement about what's going on, the communication of SIP days, and what our staff members are doing on those days, and it's being communicated, and we're seeing the improvement in our classrooms. It's still the sense of the number throughout the school year that I think is really the issue. But again, we're not going to solve that, guys. It's about this calendar for next year, and we'll deal with that issue the next time around.
You know what 87 is doing on President's Day?
They're off.
They're off.
Everybody's off but us.
Everybody's off but us.
Next year.
Everybody's off but us. Mm-hmm.
Columbus Day, President's Day, Martin Luther King Day are held by all of the consortia, the associated districts, those 3. Everyone's given up Pulaski Day.
Well,
today was Pulaski Day.
Yes, today, yeah. Happy Pulaski Day. So, last comment on this. Kara, thanks for, you know, continuing to work on the calendar committee. In the 4 years that I've, you know, had calendars come across the desk, I do think last year and this year, is a, you know, much more collaborative conversation and people get it. And I think what we have to remember as board members, we may be getting emails or comments or whatever from you know, folks in the community or fellow parents that have a particular issue. But to Kara's point, there are programmatic concerns, educational concerns, and certainly calendar concerns. And all of those have to be looked at with equanimity. I mean, there's got to be parity among that conversation. So I got an email from someone asking us to, you know, give the full week off in February because the schools in New England did that where they used to live. All right. Well.
Wow.
So, I think that what we have here is, based on what the needs are of the district right now, is again, a much tighter calendar. We addressed a lot of issues that were hot, you know, last year. Mm-hmm. And I think the board, kudos to the board, because I think we did listen very closely to that, and then to the calendar committee as well, who spent extra hours trying to figure that out. So I have had many fewer, almost non-existent, but that one email about February, knowing the calendar was coming out, comments about this, because I think they felt like we heard the issues and then the committee dealt with them.
I mean, I think back 3 years ago or however many years ago,
the number one issue was from an education perspective, that we wanted to maximize the number of 5-day weeks that we could have, because best practice has indicated you don't want to go to school 3 days, stop 2 days, or stop 4 days and then go back. And I think we just need to continue down that path as much as we can, because that's what that's best practice. So.
Going back to your desire to affect that change, how would that be done?
It's a negotiated item.
So that's solely part of the contract negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
So the original contract allowed this.
The last two contracts.
Can I let me just clarify that. Are we saying the half days are negotiated,
mm-hmm.
or couldn't we take the? I thought there was a way to take the 2 half days, make them 1 days if we banked enough hours.
We have a waiver from the state to allow us to do so, but the language of the contract is specific to 8 half days. So we would have to renegotiate that portion of the contract with either a memorandum of understanding between now and 2012, or wait until 2012 when the contract expires.
In other words, we'd have to get agreement from everybody to be able to do that.
Yeah, be a memorandum. We've done those before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our lawyer couldn't say we've got the 8 half days. They just happen on 4 days. You get a half day in the morning and a half day in the afternoon.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear. It's language in the contract,
right?
So we would have to negotiate it.
And there are reasons that the teachers have for wanting it to be laid out this way.
Correct.
So that's the conversation.
There are. There were pros to that, so that they could have more time spread across, and there was also pros to not always requiring 8 hours to learn something.
Okay, no other discussion? Roll call, please.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
No.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Nelson?
Yes.
Mrs. Howard?
Yes.
Mr. Sullivan?
Yes. Okay, the 2011 Summer Capital Projects. At its February 21st meeting, the board discussed proposed 2011 Summer Capital Projects and the administration's recommendation to approve the bid from Light Construction Incorporated in the amount of $663,237 for the base bid and alternate A2. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented?
Motion.
Second. Second. Drew. Discussion.
Bob, thanks for breaking out the details on the design work. So typically this would just be the one chunk
that's
the design piece, and so does FGM choose AMSCO and Ericsson thing? Is that just like engineering provider?
Yes and no. The AMSCO and Ericsson Engineering have had a long-standing relationship with this district. AMSCO Engineering, as a matter of fact, Dan McCurdy is one of the lead associates that's assigned to our account. He was the director of buildings and grounds for a number of years, is now associated with AMSCO, has intimate knowledge of our district. Regarding Ericsson Engineering, they're probably one of the larger civil firms in the metropolitan area. I worked with them in McHenry County. I've worked with them, obviously, here. And FGM does have at least a working relationship with them. So I've worked with all of these firms at one time or another.
Any other comments? I know we've talked about this
numerous
times
in finance. Yeah, for the record, we've had a lot of conversation. Finance approved, completed their approval. So thank you.
Okay, roll call, please.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Yes. Recommendation 3, the Hadley Courtyard Project. At its February 21st meeting, the board discussed the administration's recommendation relative to the Hadley Courtyard Project. I would like to note that the language of the recommendation has been revised to include a more explicit reference to bidding the project. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented?
So moved.
Second. Discussion.
Well, I'd like to note first before you go into your discussion that Dan and I had a conversation about this particular proposal last Friday. And in that, he mentioned that, one, he was not only surprised by the sticker price of this project, but also the memory that he had that we were going to bring three proposals to the board for discussion prior to approval. And, you know, I acknowledged to him that we did not do that. We took the three proposals to the Finance Committee, talked through those proposals to the Finance Committee, made a single recommendation to the Board of Education. And so I know that that's something you'd like to discuss, and I wanted to acknowledge at least that we did not do that. We stopped at the Finance Committee instead of bringing all three proposals here, and went with our typical structure, which is to make a single recommendation to the board rather than three options. So that's our error.
Well, not necessarily. I guess what I would suggest is that the reason that we have a Finance and Facility Committee is to vet that. And if the Finance Committee, and I don't know that I have an example of this from the past 3 years, but if the Finance Committee felt that there was some need to vet that at the board level for any various reasons, then the Finance Committee would bring that forward to the board. But my understanding is that the Finance Committee, because you meet, you know, twice a month, and have conversation with Bob outside of those meetings, that you vet those, you look at those, and then you bring, then the board, the recommendation rather, comes from the administration to the board level with what that is. So I wasn't surprised by that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went back, and Dan, I know you had made a couple comments at our last board meeting. I went back and pulled out my February 7th and February 21st notes on this to see what the number was in terms of what that potential cost was and the how that got laid out before us. So I guess I wasn't surprised by that it would come as a single recommendation, which we could then question, certainly. Mm-hmm. But
well, I just wanted to clarify. I wanted to acknowledge the fact that
I'm glad from that Dan's conversation,
the experience and what he listened to in the tapes was different than what he actually experienced.
Yeah,
right.
I just went back and listened just because I was like, am I going crazy? Or something? I remembered something differently. Mm-hmm. I know we talked about there's something, and I understand this is, you know, just a vote to go out for bid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is some things that have to be done in that courtyard that we got to take care of. So I guess, you know, if we're going to go out to bid, one of the things I'd be interested in is looking at having the bid lay out those up. Here's what needs to be done, and then here's the chosen additionals that are what to be looked at as well.
The one thing that we need to do, which we've done, we would do internally, and I'll let Bob fill in where I am not specific enough or technical enough, but what we would try to do, no matter what, is do what we've done on the outside of the building and reduce the moisture that gathers along the edge of that. And that's what we did on the outside of the building last year. Southeast wall, southeast, south, I can't
remember. The east addition, east and west sides of that building.
So
there was never drain tile installed in the area. It's created numerous difficulties over the years that we're finally able to address last.
So we would do that kind of work, and that would cost us about $5,000 to $10,000, and we would do that internally, pretty much, with some outside work to do the sheeting.
It's a membrane
that goes
we install along the exterior of the building to prevent continued leakage. And we've had conversations over the past couple of days, past few months, regarding this particular project, and I'll have additional conversations with the architects and engineers tomorrow. But what I'm probably looking to do is to have this bid structured so that there's going to be a base component to it, and then there'll be some alternative components. The base component will involve the project as well as the work that absolutely has to be done. And then we'll identify alternatives just to give us a better approximation of the commitment to the cost.
Mm-hmm. And is that what you're looking for, to see that in the bid?
Can you clarify one statement, though?
Sure.
we're approving more than just going for a bid, right?
No, you're approving to go out to a bid.
It says conceptual plans and estimated costs for development.
Right. I mean, we can't go out to bid without you seeing what we're actually going to ask to be bid on.
We're not approving the project at this point. We're approving the bid.
The opportunity to bid.
And what I thought I just heard you say was that we're going to, I guess there were three options, but we're going to get this bid in the sense of the foundation clearing up the stormwater issue and then the other elements to build on it, right?
Correct. I mean, I wouldn't think that at this point, unless you direct us differently, that we would go back and break out those other options as alternate bids. We would break out the option to create the learning environment out there from the base bid of just doing stormwater, I would guess.
If we don't touch that area, there is a really aren't any stormwater implications.
Yeah, so
right. We just leave it the way it is and keep it locked up.
And just do the moisture along the wall.
That has to be done in either case.
So
that's a project that I would do sometime throughout the summer without having to go out to bid just because of the value of the project itself.
So the question really is, if the board doesn't support the proposal that we brought, then you would need to send us back to the drawing board, which would mean we'd probably take the three options back to finance and work through those with finance. We felt we had support from finance to bring the proposal forward.
I mean, obviously the scope changed in our original thoughts to the final, and I guess my view of this is that, you know, before the scope was really some benches and some pavers, and that's about it. And I guess what I'm looking at the conceptual design at this point is more of a more robust, obviously, outdoor learning environment that can be used by multiple different types of classrooms too. So obviously, it's almost like an outdoor lab in some respects for science classes. There's an outdoor performance location for, you know, some of our performing classes. And then there's also outdoor reading space and other spaces where a regular, you know, any other type of classroom could get together. And so I guess it changed from kind of a nice space where it's like, hey, let's have a class outside today, to more of a space that can be better utilized by different disciplines, I guess is the word I'm looking for, in the school, where they can develop curricula around it. And obviously, we're talking about a lot of money, a big difference between about $200,000 difference, I think, between the number that was kind of bandied about originally and the final number, or at least what we think it might come out to be. So obviously, it's important. It'll be important and incumbent on the district to utilize the space, make sure it's utilized as much as a classroom. And we just put up three classrooms at what about $400,000 a piece for those new additions. So I'm kind of looking at it in that vein as, okay, we're adding an outdoor learning environment that the master's facility plan talked about the importance of. Mm-hmm. You know, so long as we utilize it, you know, I guess I'm kind of okay with the expense. But that part of it isn't our gig. I guess it's our decision really to say, do we want to spend that kind of money on this outdoor learning environment? And I guess when I look at the conceptual plan, you certainly see enough portions of it that can be utilized for a large variety of classrooms. We just got to make sure, well, the administration just has to make sure that it happens. Anyway.
Well, I guess, I mean, I certainly will vote that we go out and get the costs. For me, the issue is, two things. One is just getting a better understanding of how we're going to use it from a curriculum perspective, right? I mean, I see, you know, the art classes will be encouraged to use it. The math and literacy, I think, I think we need to be able to communicate better on what that is, and maybe it's in something in here that I didn't see, but in the two.
I think we talked about it probably, and more specifically in Finance Committee.
Okay.
And last time we talked about the opportunities for the science water study. We've got teachers right now that have set up pond study in their classrooms using plastic
baby pools,
and so they were very excited about the potential of having pond study out there and performance areas for, as Bob said.
So it'd be nice to, for me, just get a little bit better clarity around what the educational uses will be in our plan, and then just the option to know, you know, we might phase this in. I mean, you know, what's the cost minus the amphitheater? You know, I don't know. You know, just that's why for me, I would like to see it broken up. But I wasn't thinking just stormwater versus everything else, mm-hmm. but just to kind of understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like building anything with the.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one downside that we would say in terms of phasing this in over several years is the difficulty of getting equipment into that space, and so the additional cost that might be incurred if you phase it in because of the complexity of, as opposed to
doing it. Very, very legit.
Yeah.
You know, and go to Dan's point, I think Bob and I both have already gone through the red face number in terms of that, the space. Going through finance. And I think again, there are a lot of positives to taking that space and make that outdoor classroom out of it. And I think my concern is, you know, is it really going to be used? Will it truly be used and function as an outdoor classroom? Because I think if it's not, then we've got a lot of money for space that. It's basically a nice garden. It's truly going to be used as an outdoor classroom. I think there's a lot of functionality. I think there's a lot of long-term value into the space, and I think that's the ultimate goal here. But again, I understand your point. I mean, I think we're just a little bit further along on the process because it was vetted for quite a while in finance.
Yeah, I mean, the use is always a concern. I know during the MFP committee process, but I think I was in the study group where we were talking about outdoor learning experiences with Mr. Burke, who was instrumental in some of the outdoor learning environments being constructed, that, you know, and Bob's talked about this before, you get someone that's really jazzed up about something, you make this butterfly garden or whatever, and then it kind of, you know, after a couple of years, it kind of, you know, that person leaves, the person who was in charge of that area or was really jazzed up about it to begin with kind of left, and it kind of falls into disrepair or disuse, maybe. And so the concern with the outdoor living environments, because we've seen, you know, they've kind of been pet projects as opposed to, you know, something that's going to be a long-term, you know, well-supported, well-maintained mm-hmm. area. That's the fear, is that, okay, are we going to build a nice, great outdoor learning environment, and then 3 years from now, you know, new teachers come in or whatever, old ones leave, and they're not still in, you know, using that space in their curriculum. That's the only concern.
I would comment, though, that this is a district-led project where the others may be an isolated group of teachers mm-hmm. or an isolated group of parents. This is truly a district-led project.
Mm-hmm. Right. I will say that, you know, teachers love to be able to be outside if they can with their classrooms when the weather is permitting. So from a strictly desirable and protected way to be outside, mm-hmm. I think this will be highly desirable. You know, if you were to say, well, tell me, I want a commitment that there'll be 7 classrooms out there every week or something like that, one, weather permitting is obviously going to be a factor, and what classes are doing and what their particular study is. But I would guess, and because teachers were involved in giving Bob some mm-hmm. feedback and some insights into how they might use it, I think there's much more, you know, investment in what has been designed, because they have input into it, and the science teachers were extremely excited, so much more about a pond study than a plant study, even though there'll be opportunities for some plant study possibly. But, and again, the maintenance on plant study is exactly the butterfly garden, you know, who takes care of it, and you know, that sort of thing. So
just a couple pieces, and it refers back to something that actually Dan, you said when I think it was last year when Mike was showing us the smart board technology, and you asked a really good question and made it a good comment, and it was, are the smart boards just a glorified chalkboard? How are they going to be used? And I would reference that back to this conversation, because I think it is similar in fashion. Is this a nice, lovely area, or will it be utilized as a common learning space? And I think our teachers, from a professional development and professional level, have shown us that when given the opportunity to use space, they can do it effectively, whether it's Brian Bonkowski in the pod or Brian Liedemann teaching Dog Ate My Homework in a pod with all the noise around it. You know, they figure out how to make do. This is a landlocked building. And I was trying to remember back, but I asked my daughter, who was at Hadley now 7 years ago, as a sixth grader, and those doors were chained and locked 7 years ago.
And they still are.
And they still are. I mean, this space has been shuttered for that many years, and I would suggest that as a district asset, you know, we have, it's time to look at that, it also in light of the fact that we have a master facility plan that is going to take off, but not immediately. And so how do we utilize what's there right in front of us? So, you know, I think if we think back to the smart board comment, it would be the same here. I know that, again, in the science curriculum, because it's inquiry-based, you know, they use their classrooms all the time. My son was doing an inquiry-based activity with a center set up all around that had dirt, sand, plants, all these things right in the seventh grade classroom. So I don't know if you've had a chance to go over and actually look at the space. But if you haven't, do it. It was a long time ago when you were there, Drew, but probably looks the same.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I was there. It wasn't you.
Yeah. So I think just when you look at it and you're there physically looking at it, the enormity of the opportunity there is huge, because it is a very big space. So I think as a district asset and with commitment from the teachers as they've shown us with some of the technology, I really do think it will be utilized. The other thing is, I just did a very simple math thing, and I took the amount of money that at least it's proposed to be by doing it as proposed through finance, with the number of children that are in every year, which is around 1,200, and it breaks out to about $161 per student. So this is a building, our one building in the district, that all of our children come through at some point and utilize the services of. And so I think for me that was another, that's another piece to it, that, you know, they're coming out of a fifth grade classroom in our schools that really don't have access to a lot of good science hands-on opportunity and into potentially, you know, a learning lab. And the last piece, and Bob already brought this up, but it aligns right back to not only our visioning from 2008 and that group of people, but also the master facility plan in terms of outdoor learning. So I think it's important. I think we have to pay attention to the dollar. But I think from my perspective and what it has the potential to do, and maybe I just have a history of having children there, so I have a different lens, and I acknowledge that. But I think the cost of it and the fact that we can allow all of our children from our four feeder schools into that school to utilize this, really year on year will be a payback ultimately.
I think Bob had kind of put this project and orientated in such a way that although it's not maintenance-free, the level of maintenance to sustain this environment is significantly less than prior projects in terms of the prairie grass. Originally, it was done 11 years ago.
I mean, it was
a beautiful project, and there was a lot of support. But the level of maintenance to do that, and and then keep that up, it was a huge amount of time investment. I think this project is designed in such a way that the maintenance costs are going to be very, very minimal. I mean, basically what they're doing now. So I think from the maintenance cost aspect, I think it's the right concept.
It might be less if there's no water issues to deal with. You know,
yeah, that's true.
Just the one last thing I wanted to, and when we had chatted a little bit, I asked about some priorities. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to make sure that after the scope of change, the priorities still stayed the same.
The priorities stayed the change. And the only thing we chose not to bring forward this year for capital projects, which Bob explained earlier, was the ramp at Hadley, and Lincoln. And as Bob analyzed that, he felt the cost of that was more than he'd want to spend on something that doesn't directly benefit kids. And so this does directly benefit students, and that's the only piece that was on this year's priority list that was not done, and for very different reasons.
Any other discussion? Okay, roll call, please.
Yes.
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 Yes. Okay, item 8, the superintendent's report.
I'll try to make this quick in light of time. You have the enrollment report. I'd like to make one quick announcement for you that Hadley graduation has been rescheduled for June 2nd. So please put that into your calendar. We will not make an official announcement of that, although we'll tell people about it, until you approve the final calendar in April, when we feel like we are certain of no more weather-related days, hopefully.
Never say
never. But, you know, usually we try to do the final calendar in April because it seems safer than it does in March. But Hadley graduation has been moved by one day. To accommodate, we couldn't do 2 days because Wes will be in there on Friday, so it'll be Thursday the 2nd. The last item that I just want to, and I don't want to spend a lot of discussion time, I think probably I would just like to get the board's reaction, and then I'll know what to do after I hear your reaction. I emailed you earlier today about the possibility of sending a larger team to a national conference on model schools that is occurring in June, and that we would be doing that in lieu of our usual retreat where the entire administrative team goes. And tried to outline that plan for you, recognizing that it's an expensive venture anytime we send that many people, which would be 8, to a conference. So basically, I don't feel I can move forward with making a decision about that conference without your support or your saying, no, this is not a good time, don't do it. And I can appreciate either stance. As I said to you in my email to you, I hope you know that I wouldn't ask you or talk to you about spending money that I didn't think could truly benefit our staff. But given the magnitude of change that we are about to encounter over the next 5 years, including evaluations related to performance, including the technology that will be shifting our whole paradigm of schooling, including the deepening of our work around the learner characteristics in the long-range plan, and then, of course, the Common Core, which will become the driver for us over the next many years. We really feel, as an administrative team, we have some of our own learning to do in order to fully lead the implementation of these things that are going to occur over the next many years, and felt that this was an opportunity that, unlike others we've looked at over the course of this year, around thinking and critical thinking, deepening our thinking, this one really captured a lot of those major areas that I just mentioned to you, and taking a team would be crucial in order to sort of do the divide up and everybody go someplace and come back in the evening and talk to each other about what we've learned and how it impacts the long-range plan. We would then bring it back, and our colleagues that would stay behind, unfortunately, we'd get them up to speed. But trying to focus on the instructional leaders who have to be ready to lead their buildings and the system. So that's my plea, but I really am looking for a, I guess, to use your language, the red-faced response.
You know, I was poking around the website on this. Could I take a look at that?
Sure.
I don't know if it was just me, but I couldn't find the list of sessions.
Well, you don't have all the list of all the sessions.
But even on their website, I couldn't find them.
No, it's not, because they've got the program. The program is not fully.
Yeah, they had like the pre-conference ones, but not the whole program.
Right.
So, anyway, I just wanted to make sure it wasn't just me. That was,
no, it's the whole conference is not. All the breakout sessions are not listed.
Okay.
What's the belt? You said you were going to forego something.
Well, we've normally done an administrative retreat for 2 days at the Arboretum. We rent a room there so that we're away from the noise of this building location, and we spend 2 days there working on either next steps in the long-range plan. Or next steps in the long-range plan and other items that we may have talked about, like this year probably would be talking about Boolean recommendation implementation as well. So we would not go there. We would, when we come back, we would do our getting everybody else up to speed on here on site. So the delta for that would be,
yeah,
it's about $5,000 to go to the Arboretum.
And you're still going to do that work, you said.
We would still do the work. We would just do it here.
Yeah.
We're really asking the principals and some of the leadership team here to give up four additional days to do this work.
What is meant by next generation literacy skills?
Well, that really will be a major part of our long-range plan renewal, talking about digital literacy. There's literacy that's now coming out in terms of legal literacy, the literacy of science, more technical literacies. So when we talked about the renewal of the long-range plan at CIT, some of our literacy specialists were talking to us about, we have got to, you know, literacy in terms of a content area is changing dramatically, and what those are and how we're going to have to incorporate those into our curriculum is one of the big pieces of the long range plan in the learning characteristics.
Which, I mean, it seemed like that's what that was.
That's part of what, that's one area, one strand here.
Oh, it's just one strand. Mm-hmm. Okay. The way I read the email, it was the focus.
No, that's one focus. There's the focus on evaluation. There's a focus on developing an implementation plan for the Common Core and that transition. There's a focus on drawing a blank. Thanks. Oh, good. My email.
Well, I have your email here.
And the model schools. I think the other piece for us is being able to, they identify model schools every year, learn from them, being able to find out what's happening in other schools across the country, as well as I noticed one of them is an Illinois school, which would be great.
Mm-hmm. When I took a look at this, you referred to the red face number, and then I started to try to break it down in my head in terms of professional development and you know, what we spend per person. I mean, it's not really broken down by each individual, but I know some years you yourself, which is something that we've talked about, have not attended conferences.
National
conferences for a number of reasons. And so, you know, again, I started looking at it, thinking, trying to process it in the way of how do we look at each person? Would this group in the end, I don't want to say spend that much. I mean, would it, you know, total that much if everybody went to their own thing? And I mean, it could potentially do that. It just seems, you know, a little shocking when you do it all at once. So my assumption, and you know, Dan, you prioritize that you're going to do your conference or your retreat here, you know, would that mean that, you know, some of these other individuals would not attend another national conference for that this year? They would forego that because the quality of this one is so much greater, that they would forego attending something different. I have had the opportunity at LLT to, you know, the Common Core is constant discussion,
mm-hmm.
and to the, you know, the panic level is rising as to what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so from the academic perspective, to have our building leaders, you know, our principals, Karen, you know, to have you to get a better understanding of what the heck this thing is, would be invaluable, because it's here, it's coming, and we better figure out quickly how it's going to be implemented and how to work together to be able to do that. But I, you know, and being honest, when you look at the price tag, you go, okay, how do I, you know, how do we justify it? And that's just, you know.
Well, is this within your budget?
It is in my continuous. No, I'm not. It's in my continuous. The money is in my continuous improvement budget, and at this point, does not have an assignment to any other project.
There, your email came, I think, the day after our latest edition of School Board Journal came. You know, mm-hmm. the periodical, and the cover article. And I'm going to get the title wrong, but it made me open it up and then skim it. Yeah, Common Core, it said.
Mm-hmm.
Is the Common Core is coming? It was a picture of a ship, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, is it coming too fast? And in the article, it talked about the lack of leadership understanding how the Common Core state standards are going to impact our, you know, the district at the district level. And that one of the recommendations is to make sure that people, this isn't their language, but essentially are on the same page, because it's being pushed so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, I looked at that and then I got this email today. And so my sense of this is, in particular with our principals going, that was the key for me. They each lead a very different school. And yet one of our goals as a board has always been continuity on a lot of different levels, not the least of which now, I think, is around leadership of this transition. And we heard in our board discussions in this room with our visioning conversations the lack of, you know, good healthy stress certainly among our faculty, but also the level of distress in terms of feeling the accountability. John Bowers used that term tonight, you know, feeling the accountabilities of getting everything done. So to me, this senior leader in our buildings is really going to be the one to set the tone and either be able to help manage that distress and what's coming down. And I think a way to do that is have this knowledge. So I'm glad to see that obviously you're making a decision about the Arboretum. Lori, I did say, Lori going, and then I thought about PDT.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that piece, which is absolutely critical to then push it down into the building. So that professional development team, you know, you need to be here because of that voice. But I did say, could it be 7? But it makes sense to me that you go, because you're going to have to work with the PDT to really help understand what are the strands here to help push down in terms of learning. So I see this as an opportunity to take a breath and have probably a good primal screen together around this, because it is so much. I mean, you read. Well, please go back and read this article because it'll really give you a kind of an awakening of what this administrative team and our administrators are having to deal with. But I think you know, a way to do that is to be able to roll your sleeves up together and be able to hear the same message at the same time. And so I think there's value in that.
You know, I read through your email, and we've talked about this. This is a tough year, and I know there's a lot of financial issues. My only point would be, if you want to spend the dollars to do this, I would want a quantifiable, definable outcome as a result of going there. What's the deliverable that's going to bring back
to the board. And I think that needs to be defined prior to going there. And I'm in favor of spending the money and doing these things so long as there's a benefit that you can bring back to the board and say, as a result of attending the conference, these things are
occurring.
Are moving more smoothly than otherwise, or whatever that deliverable is.
Well, I think that's an evaluative comment, though, Drew, to be able to say, here's what's moving more smoothly because of this. So that would be like a post-implementation piece. So 6 months down the line, Scott Klesfitz being able to say, from this conference, I took these three pieces and implemented them, and now this is happening. So I agree with you. I think there's value in that, but I don't think you can do that now.
Well, I think you can put a you can say these are my expectations in terms mm-hmm. of outcomes, mm-hmm. and do
and
that before you
yeah.
go to
I guess, yeah.
And that's why I would challenge you mm-hmm. to bring back to the board and say these are our anticipated outcomes. So when you come report back after the conference, we can match those up.
Mm-hmm. And those are the kinds of things we would do as we plan with the leadership team that is going, out of the expectations for attendance. And as I said to you earlier when we talked, that obviously some of the learning that will come out of this conference for us will be implemented or addressed in the action plans of the long-range plan, too. So easy to build a deliverable in the educational sense. The quantifiable piece might not have 20% or, 80%. It mm-hmm. probably is really the action steps that will occur as a result of our learning. And some of that will be post, because we won't know exactly what we're learning until we get down there. But
Anna, are you looking for taking our temperature?
I'm looking to take the temperature.
Okay.
And if you feel you must give formal approval, then that's another stage we'd have to go through. But if you believe that this is an expenditure that if it was disaggregated, I wouldn't be asking you for permission. But in its aggregate, mm-hmm. it's something that I feel you need to be able to justify if you're asked about it. And it's important for us. We're not going to hide something. This is a large expenditure.
Well, as you said, you have the dollars in your continuous improvement budget, so you're not seeking dollars outside of what's in your budget.
No, and I've been always very frugal with that account and very careful about how it is spent, and mm-hmm. so I have typically underspent it to some extent.
It's not on the beach in Hawaii.
It's not on the beach in Hawaii.
Yeah, you don't have gold toilets.
And procedurally, were you looking for approval? Would that cycle through the finance committee?
Well, if it does that, we probably won't register, because this is a conference that fills up very quickly, and by the time we go through a 6-week cycle, we would be out of the.
So, does anybody feel the need to? Does anybody think that the board should have a formal approval vote on this expenditure? Does anyone think it's to that level, Drew?
I mean, I don't know that we're in the business of managing the, how the budget is spent. We approve the budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, to Drew's request, I think an explanation of what they think they'll get. I think we asked that already of the mm-hmm. teachers, right, mm-hmm. when they're going to mm-hmm. conferences. So that's not out of the ordinary, and I think it'd be beneficial.
And you're making a trade-off, so mm-hmm. seems reasonable.
Mm-hmm. So I guess
it's a good thing.
If we get that, then everyone's okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that conversation, and I'm sorry it took so much time. It's been a really long busy.
Okay.
A lot of good stuff on
Issue 9: Board reports. Are there any members of the board who wish to give a report at this time?
I was at LLT last week. I gave Maureen my report. We reviewed the ISTAT data. Very interesting discussion about the flat score, the scores of green flat. They're decent scores. They just, there's not, you don't see big highs and big lows. The science, I'm sorry, we looked at science. We did math and reading in the last 2 months. And just talked about the cycle of, you know, the questions. They break out the data as we're looking at it, you know, by the subject matter of the questions. And, you know, it's just a very interesting discussion because you obviously have people from all the buildings. The other thing that we talked about was we looked at the work habits rubric that's used, and we looked at it with the learner characteristics and how some of our learner characteristics fit with the work habits rubric, and it was very positive in that there was no debate about the learner characteristics. I will tell you, I was a little surprised that we had staff members who indicated that they hadn't seen them. They weren't sure where they posted somewhere. I mean, I think, you know, Julie and I were sort of playing tag team on the historical piece of where they came from. Now, many of the members there were not in the district when we did it, so I think they just weren't clear. But it was, I guess, John, you and I were there when we developed them, so it was sort of hard for me at times to remember. I remember the context, and I, you know, we talked about it and what we did, but it was, you know, I guess honestly, I was disappointed to hear them say that they didn't even know what they were or what, how do you, you know, just not that they weren't good, but that they didn't use them, that they didn't really look at them, and I was just disappointed to hear that and to feel that we had to keep giving them back the what they're about. And Karen just
wanted to focus on the new long-range plans.
Well, and Karen kept explaining that, and she would say that, and I mean, Karen obviously had a grasp of what it was and, you know, talked about it from the long-range plan perspective, and, you know, this is what we want our students to have when they leave our buildings. But, you know, I guess I didn't...
So I'd be surprised by that, too. I mean, my understanding that the learner characteristics that we developed, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, the idea of those where they were supposed to be above and beyond, you know, the standards, and they were things such as creativity and, mm-hmm. you know, some of the characteristics that we wanted the kids to come out of our education system with, and that we hoped that they would be embedded in either the way you teach or what you teach. And that's surprising.
That was
because it hasn't been the conscious language.
Yeah,
right. And that was the thing. It came up.
It hasn't been the explicit language. You know, in the unfolding of curricula, it's been probably less explicit, more embedded. It needs to be more explicit.
And that was the thing. One of the teachers, excuse me, said, you know, I'm looking at these, and, you know, while I didn't recognize, you know, didn't realize that they were learner characteristics at the district, you know, this is a 21st century learner. And I'm sort of snickering to myself because I'm thinking, well, we came up with these 5 years ago, you know, we've been talking about it, but we didn't call it 21st century learner. We call them District 41 learner characteristics. So you're right. It's you know, the talking about it. And again, it was, you know, well, you know, are these posted somewhere? Could a parent, you know, do these? And for me, it was, in addition to, you know, the stat, it just kind of, it was disappointing because I felt like it was one of those things where it's there, it's here, it's on the wall, and it's, people don't read it. And that, not just our staff, but, you know, parents, like, do they know that these exist, that they, that we are doing these things? So for me, it was just a little bit, it was disappointing. I mean, we had a great discussion, and again, there was no debate about the quality of them, and we had a great discussion on how they fit into the rubric. It just, it's one of those things that was a little disappointing. That was it. Oh, at PTA, this Thursday night at Ben Franklin is hosting their PTA meeting, but they're also hosting for all of the PTAs in the district the candidate night. I believe it starts at 7:30. Yeah,
7:30 to 8:30 is the forum. Yeah,
is the forum. So,
already
been. Well, you're the board member that's assigned to that meeting, aren't you?
No, I am.
You are?
Yeah.
Well,
I thought no, Drew's name is not.
on events in progress, I believe I am.
Let's go back to learner characteristics and board members knowing when
you're supposed to be. One of us will be there, and yes,
I'm going to be there anyway, Chris.
Right.
I was going to ask Jared to cover talking points to me. They only put 15 minutes for their meeting.
Yeah. We do not have a team. We were not able to field a team on the short notice, but we're sponsoring a team of GECRC volunteers.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's two schools that are having their fun fair that night.
Yeah. So Lincoln's not having, and then Hadley is going to field a team. So we will sponsor one, and Hadley will have one.
Yeah,
it was
fun.
Yeah,
it was
fun. It was kind of a late notice, and in this building, no one was available to make up a team. So
yeah, they didn't get their info out as early as they did last year.
Yeah.
Very quickly, Chesapeake Care report. I gave a copy to Maureen, and I just want to highlight a couple things. Number one was the technology piece and the iPads that are being used over there, and this conversation around e-readers in the fifth grade, so that teachers are having to kind of deal with that and make some decisions with Scott. And also some kudos to Mike Wood. There's a new position on the Hadley PTA, which is Vice President of Technology. They have a really nice website Churchill put together, and wanted to thank Mike for his support and the team.
Okay.
I can make an even quicker report.
And
let's see.
Go.
Jim and I went to the PEP meeting, and the issue was initially what's going on with the information packages. Is PEP listed?
You mean like in our registration packets?
Right.
Okay. The check the boxes in their registration.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anything else?
I do it.
Finance committee, we talked briefly at the end of our meeting about our meeting next Monday and the agenda. Since it's 10 to 11 and I didn't write anything down, I'll turn it over to Ann to this. Recap what we talked about.
We talked about trying to get through at least the first part of the short-term recommendations and talking about Spalding. First, reviewing the PowerPoint again, just so everybody has a chance to kind of latch onto that one more time. Talking about Spalding as the first topic of the evening and whether Spalding's a viable site or not. Then moving to a large parcel and what we might want to discuss around that. Funding, if we were to fund, if we were to purchase a large parcel, how we might go about funding. We wanted to return perhaps to the small parcel conversation that we had about a year ago. And then important to articulate that we are, now this is a full board conversation and not just a finance. In the April meeting, we moved to the demographic update and the process for deciding which of the three options and what kind of engagement process we would want to do to decide that those three options.
So those were kind of the agenda items we'd laid out. In the interest of time, if you have something you'd like to add or change to that list, you can email myself and Ann and or Steve, rather, I guess.
Sounds good.
All right. Any other board reports? Hearing none, we will move on to...
Just one that Hadley had their destination imagination.
Oh, how'd they do?
Regionals. Mm-hmm. And we had several teams that placed either first or second, and we'll be moving on to a state.
Great.
So good. Congratulations to...
And yeah, Churchill had two teams for the first year.
Did you come?
You feel different?
One of the young ladies on the team, Catherine Kenwood, did come in second place. Yes.
All right.
And the two did, and there was a third grade team won from Red Plains. They came in first. And what about the other? I mean, there were a couple teams.
Yeah, they did well.
Next we go.
Great. Okay. Discussion items. Benjamin Franklin Net Abatement Project.
One of the projects that were listed originally in the full summer capital projects plan is the lead abatement project for the front entranceway at Ben Franklin. And I don't think Bob brought up the plaster, the part of it, but what will happen is there'll be lead abatement and then a rebuilding of the historic entryway to Ben Franklin, and so this is just, we have to do the lead abatement, and after that, this new aggregate material.
You showed it.
Yeah,
you brought a sample.
Yeah, we won't have lead anymore after that. So this is really just to get that lead out of the way. Nothing more.
Just my question on the. Mm-hmm. I know the recommendation is go with the cheapest one here. The prices are so different. Do we know this is a safe way of doing it?
Well, that was going to be my question. We always see disparity in these, but
but this is pretty wide, and there's still a subset that are within the range.
But it might be size of the company, number of employees.
Everyone has to be AAA bonded. We make sure that everyone has a AAA rating. For their company.
Financially,
and if their insurance.
Carry the adequate insurance to get the job done.
Yeah.
And as I recall,
this
work with this or
Valor Technologies has done lead abatement work for the district previously. They have a good track record, and they were recommended by the Concept 3 architects who handles all of our abatement work.
Yeah. And since we said their name, I certainly was not implying they didn't. I just want to make sure that
we're
comfortable with the
quality.
Yeah. And I received a recommendation from Concept 3 saying that this is a quality firm to go with.
Okay. Great.
Okay. That's just discussion. We'll take action on this next time, I assume.
That's correct. Yeah.
All right. And the Abraham Lincoln Stage Replacement Project.
This, as many of you know, we've had concerns expressed to us both by staff and parents at Lincoln for a couple of years regarding the stage and having it replaced. We moved this project up in priority, and Bob's been working with a variety of vendors, but it's a custom-built stage, therefore there aren't a lot of people, so a little difficult to do the competitive bidding or even pricing because there aren't a lot of people who are able to do this work. So this is a request to have this stage built. We believe it's an important both enhancer and safety issue for Lincoln, and so recommend that the board approves a new stage replacement at Lincoln.
Two quick questions, Bob. It says it's 10 feet high and 24 inches long. I assume that means when it's folded up.
Correct.
Okay. And the district language says wood stage surface, but it says wood or carpet.
24
inches. We'll go with the wood.
It's almost there.
Okay, it's not like spinal belt. You're going to Velcro a carpet.
No, it's going to be a wood stage carpet. A wood stage.
Okay, thank you.
My only question about these stages, I know this is something we've got to do, I feel like we're being asked to make these investments in our schools for the stages. They're elementary schools, they're middle school, and that's who should be using them. Mm-hmm. That's the point of it. Yeah, we have some we have sometimes PTAs that don't want to use the stage or they want to go somewhere else. And I realize it's a PTA function, but it's a little so frustrating that we're investing money so that these stages can be used for the proper functions. And then, they don't use per se.
They're used certainly widely within the school and for music performances and that sort of thing. Some of the drama performances, frankly, draw too many people to have them in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
If they were limited to one parent and no siblings.
Hadley does their drama production at Hadley, which is what they should do. It's mm-hmm. a middle school performance, and that's where they should be held. And
and we redid that.
Right, and it's beautiful. That's what I'm saying. We have our elementary schools sometimes are going outside of there because of of
PTA.
The size.
But that's PTA functions.
I recognize that. I'm just saying PTAs are part of our schools, and that
we
maybe if it's a better stage, they'll use it.
And that's my hope. Just like, you know, if we build it, they will come.
And this is a different stage than at any of other elementary schools,
right,
which are built in older, you know, those older stages.
Right. Right.
It's a platform.
I saw it. It was so frightening when I saw it.
I don't know who designed that school, Richard.
Is it going to have, does that money include the Dan Smith Memorial mats so he doesn't run into it when he's playing basketball?
Which I did last
time. We talked about that, Matt.
Right.
So we'll bring this back for approval at the next meeting. The next item really is an item that we would, if you are comfortable, ask that you move it to action. This is an item you have already had a discussion on. This is a revisiting of a discussion item that we had last fall, and at that time believed that the village was not going to ask us to do any stormwater work on this, and then Jeff, after you had your first discussion, the village let us know that there probably was some stormwater that needed to be incorporated into this. And so, really, over the last several months, Bob's been working with the village to make sure that we have the right plan and the right project. And so we're bringing it back to you now because we have approval, and we know exactly what we need to do in terms of that stormwater retention. And I believe it takes us up to like 100 feet.
It's just within 100 cubic feet of our maximum allowance for that
site. So if we do anything else, sneeze, I believe is what you said, we will not be able to do it. But this, we can do it with the stormwater that we have currently. So
it took about 3 or 4 months or 5 months to resolve it.
So the project has not changed at all in scope, and if we can move forward on it, then we perhaps could have it done before the rainy season. Well, maybe that's a little ambitious.
Could I make a motion that we move this to a vote?
It's going to be, I mean, this
it,
is...
It will be if we...
Right, but yeah. This is to go to bid. This is to...
That's correct.
To send it out.
Right. That's correct.
Yeah, right.
We talked about this in finance today.
Right. No, but it's to send it out to... I mean, the action is to send it out to bid.
Correct.
Well, does anybody... Sorry.
Excuse me. The contractor who originally bid on this report came in at under the $25,000 threshold. So what I would request, again, is to meet with a group of contractors, define the scope of work, and then take competitive pricing from them. If we can stay within that $25,000 limit, I would like to take that course of action. I go out to bid. I have to engage the services of the architect. It's $3,500 to $5,000, so then they develop bid documents and so forth. I'd like to get this project done this spring and chip in as quickly as possible.
Okay. But you're still not asking permission to move forward tonight without bringing back final project.
No. That's what you're going to bring the bids back, and we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay. It's just the exploratory.
Correct.
Does anyone have an issue with this going to an action item tonight?
No.
Okay, then let's move on to action items. Superintendent's recommendation for possible action on Forest Glen parking lot project. May I have a motion to approve the it's like Ron Burgundy, you know. Don't read anything that's on there. Okay, may I have a motion to approve the administration's earlier recommendation to approve the concept of the Forest Glen parking lot expansion project and grant permission to solicit bids for completion of the project.
Motion.
Second?
Second.
Take your pick, Mrs. Stecker. Okay, discussion.
Yeah, we already discussed.
Yeah, now we can discuss the merits of the project. Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, roll call, please.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mrs. Howard?
Yes.
Mr. Allen?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, upcoming meetings. The following are the upcoming meetings of the Board of Education, March 21st, 2011. The Board of Education regular meeting at 7:30 p.m. at the Central Services Office. And April 4th, 2011, the Board of Education regular meeting at 7:30 p.m. at Forest Glen School. Are there any other matters to be considered by the Board?
I just want to say kudos to the Bright Red Apple Award. That came out on E-News. Thank you, Julie, for getting this out. And also the excellence in financial reporting. Kudos.
Okay. Hearing no other matters. Public participation. Are there any members of the public who wish to address the board at this time? Hearing none, the board has determined that it does not have a need to adjourn to closed session. May I have a motion to adjourn the March 7, 2011 board meeting?
Motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.